Good morning, everyone. Would like to call this meeting of the Water Commission to order. I'll be stepping in for Chair Joe Byrne this morning. So we'll start off with the roll call.
Commissioner Ball?
Present.
Commissioner Byrne, absent. Commissioner Curtin?
Present.
Commissioner Dalbosky?
Here.
Commissioner Daniels?
Here.
Commissioner Herrera?
Here.
Commissioner Orth?
Here.
Commissioner Quintero?
Present.
Okay, we have a quorum. All right, so we'll go to approval of the minutes.
I had some corrections on page 4. It's the fifth paragraph under my comments. It was noted that there was farmers in my family, and that should read farm workers on both references.
Where on page 4 was that?
It's, I believe, the fifth.
1, 2, 3. Okay, we'll make that change.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Move approval.
Okay, second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Minutes stand as approved. All right. So we'll go now to the executive officer's report.
Good morning. So first, a logistical item. I just wanted to mention that the commission will be using speaker cards for public comment and has those at the back table. And those can be used both for public comment during the public testimony period and after each agenda item. And you can give them to staff at the front table. The commission has a scoping survey for the water storage investment program that has been open since late February. We initially received 162 responses within the first several weeks. And then the commission decided to extend the initial deadline to allow time for more public responses as they conducted the initial outreach program. Following last month's three public meetings, we have not had a significant increase in the number of responses received, and they have slowed to a trickle and stopped. So at this point, staff plans on closing the scoping survey on May 31st. But as discussed yesterday, the commission could always choose to issue a similar survey later in the process. I'd like to note that on April 30th, Governor Brown proposed a new alternative to what was previously the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. The new proposal, Alternative 4A, separates conveyance facility from habitat restoration into two separate measures called California Water Fix and California Water Eco Restore, and there are handouts on both of those in your binders. Previously, the commission had received regular updates on the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, and so I am happy to schedule a briefing on these two new efforts at a future meeting if it would please the Commission.
Okay, I think that might be a good update.
And that's all I have.
All right. Anything further? Okay, are there any Commission member reports?
I just wanted to report that last week, I believe on the 12th, I had a meeting that was called by former Senator Dean Flores with the Semi-Tropic Water District in Wasco, where we had a discussion about the local water needs and a project they're working on that will likely seek funding from Prop 1, the Storage Investment Program.
Thank you. Commissioner Orth?
I'll also report that in the last month, I've actually participated in a tour of the proposed Temperance Flat site with representatives of the Flint Water Authority and the Bureau of Reclamation and their consulting team. And then just shortly before that, I think it was shortly prior to the last month's meeting, was participated in a similar briefing relative to the semi-tropic, some projects that they're proposing down there, and I'll file written reports on both of those with more details.
Okay. Commissioner Quintero?
3 weeks ago, I went and visited with some of the leadership team from Santa Clara Water District, and I toured their facilities, including their water purification plant, and was great. It was great to see the site. Santa Clara? And I'll be filing a report on that conversation.
Nothing further. I do want to announce that the commission met in closed session yesterday to select the new executive officer. The commission ranked two top candidates and authorize department personnel in consultation with Commission Chair Joe Byrne to negotiate an employment offer. Okay, we'll go down now to the next agenda item. Any public testimony? There's time to, there will be opportunities to comment after each agenda item, and there will be speaker cards available. Okay. The chair will call speakers up to the podium, and we may have, if it doesn't look like there's a lot of people here, that we have to limit it, but we would like to keep them short and concise. Thank you. All right, so agenda item 7, the briefing by Aqua on water storage recommendations. Mr. Tim Quinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I'm here to report on this document. You should have a copy of it. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that my organization, the Association of California Water Utilities, by the way, my name is Tim Quinn. I'm the executive director of Aqua. We are the keepers of the flame for comprehensive solutions in California water. We demonstrated that a couple of years ago by coming up with something we call our Statewide Water Action Plan, which looks remarkably like the state's California Water Action Plan. If you're going to hold a statewide coalition of public agencies together, it's got to be through a comprehensive approach. You can't pick the silver bullet of your choice. So that's sort of why we come from where we come, and we've kind of put our money where our mouth is, most prominently, I think, in recent years with our groundwater principles that were central in passing the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act last year. I spend a lot of my time thinking about upper watersheds, because we have just come out with a framework document on upper watersheds. So we're interested in everything from what's under the ground at near sea level to what's to managing watersheds in the upper watersheds. And today I'm here to talk about a task force effort about 6 weeks in the making on storage and the role of storage in the past and future of California. One way to think about this is we've been taking our statewide water action plan and then strategically elements that need more clarification, that need more detail. We've been focusing experts from around the state. In this case, we had 18 experts on a task force. They were typically not Aqua board members, but they represented a very wide range of expertise from virtually every part of California coming to their conclusions. And so I want to start sort of with a bit of a history lesson about the evolution of storage. I know for some people, storage is that antiquated 19th century management tool that doesn't really have a place in modern California water management. It won't surprise you that that's not where we came down. Virtually every generation of water managers has relied on storage, and that's not going to change in the near future. I don't know, anybody recognize this guy? That's Michael O'Shaughnessy. Yeah, Southern California audiences will almost always say they think it's Mulholland. That's Michael O'Shaughnessy. He was the architect of the Hetch Hetchy project. Guess who his chief consultant was? William Mulholland. And I could have also had a picture. It's hard to find a picture of Arthur Powell Davis. He was previously commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, up to his eyeballs in the Owens Valley project to get water to L.A. He was the first general manager of East Bay Mud and the architect of the Pardee project. By the way, you know who his principal consultant was? William Mulholland. It was an era in which you built storage to move water distances to take care of your economy. It lasted 30 or 40 years, and it kind of ended in the middle of the last century when the state and federal government started taking charge of developing projects and investing in storage. That's a picture of Shasta Reservoir from the side. For about 30 years, maybe a little more, but not as long as you might think, it was the state and federal government that were building storage projects for these large inter-watershed projects that were looking at a much broader scope in the California economy than just one locality. In my career, starting in 1985. That's when I went to work for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Storage has taken another evolutionary step. It has remained a critical management tool. That's a picture of Los Vaqueros Reservoir, Diamond Valley Lake, and an aerial shot of the Kern Water Bank. The stories moved again away from state and federal leadership to regional leadership. As a typical rule, the storage facilities were a little bit smaller, not that much smaller than what they had been before. We moved them off stream. We moved them closer to the ultimate user of the water. And we tended to move the water when it was wet, not when it was dry. All of that in contrast to the previous paradigm of storage in the state of California. These projects were an important evolution. I spent much of my career developing them, but they were pretty regional in focus. They were financed by regional or local water managers, and they were trying to eke out as much regional local regional benefit as they could. That's why they were willing to pay for them. I think this model, which has also lasted about a quarter century, the eras seem to happen in about 30-year increments. We're ready to move into the next 30-year increment and figure storage out. And I don't know that there are more important people in the state of California than yourself to figure out what that needs to look like. Our group of experts took a hard look again. I found it interesting. Virtually every region, we break the state down into 10 regions. Every one of those regions think investments in storage is important as it pursues the policies of the 21st century. Most of them are interested in both surface and groundwater. It's a false dichotomy. You can pick one or the other. You've got to invest in both and make them work together, something I would urge you to keep in mind as you do your job over the next couple of years. Personally, I like the policies we're operating under today better than I think I would have the ones 50 years ago. They're governed by co-equal goals and groundwater sustainability. Those are kind of at the heart of California water policy, and you're going to need infrastructure to accomplish those goals that we don't have today. We think integration is essential, and if you ask me exactly what do I mean by that, I'm not going to be able to give you a very good answer. We need to work together on that. The best example, I think, of the value of integration is the recent study that was done by TNC, the Nature Conservancy, and Jay Lund, which showed surface storage alone does something but not much. Groundwater storage alone does something but not much. Both of them together do more. Both of them combined with conveyance solutions can do a lot. And we need, as you're thinking about moving forward and investing in particular projects, you have the power to force people to get creative about what integration means, and we would encourage you to use that power. Storage was pretty much the only water supply tool in the Mulholland era, in the middle of the last century. It is today an indispensable tool, but only part of a toolbox. As the governor says, you have to check the box next to all of the above. Well, storage is one of those boxes that we need to be taking care of. To add clarity to it, and I'm not going to have a lot of rocket science for you here. When my organization tends to produce common sense when it works well, rocket science is harder to get by. But we created a task force. Interestingly, a former member of your body, Paul Kelly, who's not really a water guy anymore. He's working out of water, but he came back to chair this task force and put a lot of time and energy into it. The other gentleman there is Craig Ewing. He was the vice chair. We like to hook up northern and southern leadership teams. Paul is the northerner and Craig is the southerner. And they set about managing this group of 18 to do two things: to articulate a vision for 21st century storage and to provide recommendations to you, which we reserve the right to evolve over time as to how you ought to go about allocating these dollars that you're charged with allocating. With the first one, again, not a lot of rocket science here. We've got a visioning statement in our document in which basically we ask the participants, what do we need to have on the ground in 2040? And we picked 2040 because that's when the groundwater legislation comes into full bearing, and you're supposed to have your groundwater basins in balance. And not surprisingly, in our vision, there's a significant investment in additional surface storage, combined with groundwater storage. For what it's worth, in my history at the Metropolitan Water District, for every acre foot of surface storage capacity that MWD created over a 25-year period, they created about 3 acre feet of groundwater storage capacity. So the ratio was 3 to 1. I'm not sure what the ratio is in the future for the projects you'll be looking at, but that doesn't have a bad feel to me. It's a system in which we have much more operational flexibility and integration in the system. Again, we're going to need to sort through exactly what that means. IRWMs are really important in this vision. I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that when you conserve water, when you reduce your demand for consumptive water use, you are creating a buffer that you can put into storage when the system can allocate you the water. From an environmental perspective, it's a pretty good place to get your water for storage. I mean, conserve first, then store, pull that water up when it's dry. That's been central to Southern California's vision, and I think it has a role to play elsewhere in California as well. And let me spend just a moment on this more flexible regulatory approaches. What does that mean? Well, in a nutshell, we need the regulators to go through the same sort of transformation that my industry has been through over the last 25 years, and they need to work with us to figure out how to make storage happen instead of putting all their energy in how to make storage not happen. And if you look at the bells and whistles that we had to put in Chapter 8 of Proposition 1, there's a lot of places where a regulator can stop you in your tracks. We need the regulators trying to help us figure out how to get it done in the cause of co-equal goals and long-term groundwater sustainability. As for advice to the commission on Chapter 8 of Proposition 1, we think the whole bond was important, but we especially think this was a break from the past. $2.7 billion sent directly to this commission to promote the public benefits of storage. That's a different concept from anything we've done in the past. Storage has generally not been about public benefits. It's been more about private benefits. That's why the locals were willing to pay for it. We're trying to enter a world in which we're investing in storage for both public and private benefit, and your job is to make sense out of the public benefit financial share of that. To do so, we think you do need to keep reminding project proponents, a few of which are out here in the audience, that you're kind of responsible for the success of storage in California in the future. They're the ones who are really responsible. I mean, when we pass this proposition, I think some people think that that a fully developed dam is going to drop in their backyard some Christmas Eve, and that's not going to happen. They need to realize that what Proposition 1 did was give them the opportunity to compete for some state funds, and that's really important. If we do anything, Prop 1 deserves a heck of a lot of credit for getting it done. But that doesn't build your project. They got to make the case to you guys that their project can compete for public dollars and under Chapter 8 and the terms and conditions of Chapter 8. They got to get their environmental permits. In some cases, that will mean if you're claiming fish benefits, Fish and Game has to agree with you. If you're claiming water quality benefits, then the state board has to agree with you. And all that takes a lot of work. I don't think the regulators care much that the voters overwhelmingly approved a bond in November of 2014. You got to get your permits in order if you want to get your projects built, and you have to get your partners in order. I mean, you've got to demonstrate that your project is meeting the, I think this is where integration will come to meaning. If you don't integrate with others and the projects and water supply efforts of others, it's going to be really difficult to raise the cost share. So that's sort of the gauntlet, and it's not too strong of a term, that a project proponent has to get through. But again, at least we have defined the rules of the game. I worked for many years with the chief planner. All he wanted to know was which boxes did he check off. He didn't care if they were complex. He didn't care if there was a lot of them. He just wanted to know what are the boxes to check off so he could get a project built. And he was the modern thinkers of before we invented the term. His name was Wiley Horn, the chief planner at Metropolitan Water District. And he was a co-equal goal guy before anybody else thought of coining the term. In terms of specific guidance, there's a couple of pages devoted to that to you. And like I said, not rocket science. We think it's really important that you're reading Chapter 8 and that you're ensuring that these projects fully implement the provisions of Chapter 8 to improve operations of the state water system. I was very involved in the negotiations of this chapter of the water bond, and its intent was to move storage in a direction away from just regional, just local benefits to something that had broader geographic benefits that helped the system as a whole operate. And that's not an accident. It was intentional, and I think it's important for California's future, and it's up to you to help figure out how to make that happen. Second, we think it's important to recognize that the storage needs and opportunities are diverse and widespread. It's not just those two projects that are mentioned sometimes as being the things that you're supposed to put all the money into. To me, this says you should develop a vision. I know it's you're at risk of getting pulled down into the weeds on the crossing of the T's and the dotting of the I's. You know, let your staff handle a lot of that. We do need you to come up with a vision of what you think storage needs to look like in 2040, the kind of exercise that we went through. We're going to continue, by the way, at Aqua working on quantifying and figuring out what we mean, and we will work closely with the commission and its staff and other state agencies. But we do think you need to have a vision of what you think storage needs to look like out there in 2040, and that vision should play a key role in your – don't allocate the money project by project by project absent a vision. You need to develop a vision first and then be prepared to spread money around that fulfills your vision. The third element is called allocating Chapter 8 funds wisely. We think that means in the first instance to leverage your dollars. It may be that there are projects out there that are really important to your vision and are so heavily laden with public benefits that you need to give them 50% cost share, which is the most you can do under the law. But as a general rule, our advice to you is don't give projects 50%. Give them less. We'd like to leverage that $2.7 billion for more storage infrastructure, not less. We are strong believers in giving the CalFed project a chance to move forward. That's those two projects that, and others that folks mentioned. You know, they've been through a lot of process. They make sense to us. We understand that there's no sort of entitlement to this money, but we think they should be encouraged to compete. And if they can successfully compete, they would justify, we think, giving the word substantial amount of these funds to them. You'd be surprised how long we argued over the use of the word substantial. And some people were on both sides were not happy when we were done. Substantial to me means a majority, some sort of substantial majority of the funds going to those projects, which, again, or fulfilling the vision that we think the voters approved when they approved Proposition 1. But the CalFed storage projects are not the only projects that should be funded. Two examples, you're going to get, it was mentioned that you've gotten a proposal from Semi-Tropic Water Storage. I'm encouraging my membership in Southern California to think about how can they meet the public interest test of Chapter 8 and put some some projects on the table to compete. We think south of the Delta, if you can shift demands from the wet periods to the dry periods to move us much closer to Gulf SIP than we are today, we think that meets the test of Chapter 8, and I've certainly been encouraging members to think about that as a model and welcome projects coming into the mix. You're also going to get some projects from up above the rim dams, from the upper watersheds, as they're struggling to better manage those watersheds. And again, what they're hearing from Aqua is, okay, figure out how you're going to do it different than you would have in previous decades because you have to do it differently and meet a public benefits downstream if you're expecting to get any of the money out of Chapter 8 of Proposition 1. The encourage integration, again, one of the things the Department of Water Resources did in allocating bond funds in the first decade of this century, they made IRWMs real. If you didn't have a good integrated plan, you didn't get money. And we think you need to make integration of the broader physical assets in the system part of the price tag of getting the money that you're in control of. You know, if we don't know what it means now, force people to figure it out to your satisfaction and make that a criteria as you're allocating dollars. And then lastly, I think this probably goes without saying, we think it's really important for you to preserve your authority. You need an open and transparent process, which I commend you for. But definitely don't. You should be relying on your experts for technical advice, not policy direction. That includes us, by the way. You've got an important job to do. We need you not in the weeds, but above having a policy vision. And I can't say, I don't think anything more important is happening in California in terms of where we go within the rest of this century in an effort to get it right. Now, last slide. We think you're in a position to make integration happen. You're in a position to develop infrastructure that provides resiliency for co-equal goals and for groundwater sustainability. And we can't get there without the right kind of infrastructure as we move forward in the 21st century. Glad to answer again. I think Aqua has produced another kind of common sense result. It'd be difficult for a statewide association to come down a lot differently from this. It kind of fulfilled what I expected of it when we started, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Yes.
Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Paula. Nice.
I know. I just wanted to say hi again. I feel like I've been briefed for you for at least a decade, and it's always helpful.
That's because you have.
But I wanted to see if you could maybe talk a little bit more about integration and some ideas you might have for how we can help people across the state understand the need for integration. Well, we've been holding public workshops, but are there other types of things or activities or other groups that are working on it that could help?
Sort of, okay. Two bits of advice. I would push forward, let people know you're really interested in learning more about that and that it's going to have a role in how you allocate dollars. That will catch people's attention. Do it in an open and transparent process, and then force people to be quantify it wherever they can. As I said, I think the best example of that so far, it's an imperfect study, as all studies are, but the study that Jay Lund has been summarizing, which showed the substantial benefits of connecting these projects to each other. By the way, ACWA is going to be launching on something like this ourselves, pulling different project proponents together, saying, okay, how would you guys hook your projects up to each other? And how can we quantify the benefits of doing that to try and get project proponents out of their silos where they're thinking just about their project competing with others? We need these projects to be connected to each other, and we need these projects to be connected to the existing system, which we need to be thinking about how do we reoperate. Mm-hmm. So, again, I'm saying make it clear that you think this is important. Keep everything open and transparent. ACWA is going to try and start putting more numbers to this stuff. We didn't have the ability to do that in the report that we did in about 4 months. But let's start making it a numerical exercise and start exploring what integration means. We've got the ability to do that. Okay. It's the institutions that are the problem, not the modeling or the concepts.
And where are you working in particular on helping folks understand integration? Is it geographic or project-based?
We have to go the whole state, and we will include project proponents, and we will include
you
people
are.
That are not project proponents, but care about how the system operates as a whole.
Thank you.
Commissioner Curtin.
Thank you, Tim. I also want to thank you for the enormous work that ACWA has been doing, really providing a tremendous amount of guidance, and I think really good information for everybody on this commission, but also in general, the State Water Action Plan, so on and so forth. Of course, your message on integration, I think, is well received here. I was hoping we would have a resolution prepared for this meeting. We discussed it in the Fresno meeting, but I believe we will have something prepared for the next meeting to encourage integration in the during the process of submitting proposals. One caveat, I keep thinking that if we over-encourage it, there might be some proposals that we don't see individually. So I'm thinking that we should find a way to allow people to submit their proposals individually as well as part of a larger package. It's a little complicated, but I think it can be done. We've encouraged our staff to look at proposals individually, but then to think through where it might make sense to put them together in an integrated fashion. So if I'm not mistaken, the proposals that come in will be public record. Am I right on that? And if you're looking at that independently, you'll see the proposals that are coming in. Hopefully you'll encourage people who may not have put a proposal together to think it through. But also we wouldn't mind your take on the integration process as well as our staff going through it. Any help we can get in that area I think will be critical to getting a larger set of proposals that make sense together. The question I keep wondering about is the operational flexibility. It sounds good to me, but I don't quite understand what it means. I know you can operate a reservoir in several ways, preparing for winter storms that may or may not come. And if you have more groundwater capabilities, you could move water perhaps more quickly out of a reservoir, preparing for potential rains. Is there something else more unique about operational? I mean, I know it's probably tied up in a lot of contracts and, you know, that sort of thing.
Institutions do tend to get in the way. The existing contract system can get in the way. For me, flexibility means to maximize your ability to be opportunistic. And we don't have a system today, by the way, that does that.
But do we sort of have a system that prevents that to some degree, correct?
I wouldn't disagree with that.
So while we're working this through, it would be helpful to understand that in a way that so if we do get regional-type projects, we can sort of help or insist on certain operational procedures that might make it more flexible, that could change the paradigms a little bit. So I know I'm going to need more input on that because I don't quite understand it, so. But once again, thank you.
Commissioner Ball.
So under your recommendations for Prop 1 implementation, under item 2, you want us to recognize that storage needs and opportunities are diverse in scale, location, and function.
No, it's middle.
The second part of that, you talk about some projects of merit, however, will not be eligible for Chapter 8 funds and may need alternative funding sources. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? If there are projects of merit that do not meet the requirements of funding under Prop 1, Chapter 8, how do you think we should consider those?
Well, I'm not sure you can.
So why do you bring that up?
Because I have members who have projects like that and are worried about where the funding is going to come for them. So it's not going to come from you because your charge is restrained to benefit the Bay Delta watershed.
Right.
If I've got member agencies that are interested in storage strategies in the Central Coast that's not hooked up to that system, or up in the Pacific Coast of California that's not hooked up to that system, but they have storage needs. Again, I'm the statewide guy, so I can't take a block of my members and say, well, we're going to worry about your storage needs, but the other guys are out of luck. So that's a sentence that just says, you guys are dealing with a big chunk of California, but there are other parts of California that have storage needs, and we're not going to leave them out of the picture.
So in pointing that out, are you implying that those should be considered as far as the integrated water supply system?
Okay. Not really, no. I mean, they're tougher to integrate because of where they're located. But as I said, that reflects the diversity of Aqua membership, most of whom can connect to this integrated system and can get creative about how they want to propose their storage and compete in theory for Chapter 8 dollars, but
okay.
Those that are in isolated portions of California.
That clarifies that. So you put together quite a formidable water storage policy task force, and this is the first recommendation from that task force. What do you think the efforts are going to be focused on going forward?
I'd like to start focusing on this concept of integration. What does it mean? Can we quantify it? Basically taking the Jay Lund Nature Conservancy study as a starting point. They built a lot of constraints into that study that I'd like to loosen and see what happens. But Jay's a good friend, and I admire him greatly. I've never agreed to his conclusion that you can only get X million acre feet of storage out of the system based on his study. His study just wasn't robust enough. I mean, one example, in that study, they limited the ability to get water underground to in-lieu capabilities in a particular part of California. Well, in my career, I've negotiated groundwater storage agreements where you invest heavily in replenishment basins that can get water under the ground pretty fast. The Kern Water Bank can get water under the ground almost at surface storage levels. I mean, there's a lot of capability to do this, both in lieu and direct replenishment. I'd like to really start asking the question, if you really started loosening the constraints on this system, how much gulp sip can you do? And I think the answer is a lot more than we think.
Well, I appreciate this report and look forward to hearing from you in the future. Thank you.
I can guarantee you'll be hearing from me.
I'm sure of that.
Commissioner Quintero.
Good morning, Tim. I'm really excited for the commission and for the state to take a look at what you're going to be doing with regards to watershed guidance that you'll be providing, because I think when you talk about surface storage and groundwater, a huge missing piece is what we can actually capture within the watersheds if we manage them differently statewide. And for each hydrologic region, there's going to be different challenges in each area. And that's going to be a long-term solution, but I think it can also mean long-term benefit for the state. And I'm struck that, what folks always want to know the forecasting in terms of when rain will come, and what sort of weather technology can be applied to give us a better sense of how much water is going to fall out of the sky. But it seems like we've been slow as a state to apply new technologies to understanding water in terms of what we have and how we're measuring it and managing it in the systems. And I would actually like to see more from Aqua with regards to recommendations on the measurements and management ideas around the different parts of the system, because ultimately we're not going to be able to manage what we're not measuring. And there's a lot of gaps like that right now in the system. And I think that's going to make a lot of difference for the users, the planners, and also the public perception about what exists. I think that we've all heard all the different stories about how much water is going to where, in California, whether it's going to people or fish or all of those different arguments. But it's interesting to it would be great to have a set of numbers that everybody could refer to that's sort of consistent, especially with the complexity of the conversations that we're going to be having in the coming years. So thanks so much for this work.
I'm pretty low on the learning curve on some of that stuff, particularly the upper watersheds. I'm a water manager, spent my entire career near sea level. but there are some really exciting innovations about how you measure things that you start to become acquainted with when you start looking at those upper watersheds. Mm-hmm. What JPL and others can do is pretty amazing. We're moving up that learning curve. I don't understand exactly how the watershed fits in with the rest. It's too early to be there. But my board of directors has come to the realization that they care a lot about it, and so it's a high priority for us this year.
Yeah, Commissioner Curtin.
The one thing I haven't heard you mention, and I'm wondering if there's a way to integrate, is the flood control issues out there. If we can figure out if existing flood control channels can be altered in such a way that we might be feeding groundwater capture, or new flood control measures need to be taken with the idea of, rather than moving the water out, trying to find places for it to land. I'm sure people have been trying to do that for a time, but I didn't see or hear about that in your.
It's not there, but it's a very good comment.
So I'm also reminded
of conversations with my old dear friend Tom Graff, who was a major proponent of integrating flood management into water management and storage strategies.
So maybe you can help think that through on your side of the fence. I wanted to make a comment that was at our last meeting. From Modesto Irrigation District, I'm not sure, but they made a comment about the high carbon content in the water because of the upper watershed fires in their basin. And I hadn't actually thought about it that way, but we do know that if we don't manage the forest right, the forest fires are going to be worse. But from the storage perspective, I hear numbers anywhere from 5 to 15 or 20% more capture in the upper watershed if the forests are managed better. Aside from, having to treat water in Modesto now because of the high carbon content coming out of their normally pristine watershed. So there is a real distinct connection, and we really got to figure out a way to get hooked up where we're going to put reservoirs for storage, that we push up the ladder and make sure we get the most out of the watershed for a variety of reasons, cleaner, better water, and more water. So,
with your permission, I'll send you all a copy of our we call it the Headwater Framework document.
Yeah,
if you read the first 4 or 5 pages of that, what really blew me away was the breadth and variety of benefits you get, according to the experts, of better management of those watersheds. It's healthier habitats up there, but it's fire management. It fits the governor's climate concerns. Potentially, it's one of the few places we can get significant water supply benefits and water quality benefits downstream and not be at each other's throats. There's a lot going on upstream that we ought to be paying attention
to. So other members of the commission may be getting tired of me repeating this, but it seems to me we have the opportunity to push this integration mm-hmm. up the hill and sort of help that whole process along. We can't mandate it, but, we can look more kindly on proposals that include it. And I also think there's finances available outside of the regular water world for that kind of activity.
Actually, there was just a competition at the Haas Business School of Berkeley to see who would have the sort of most innovative new financial investment ideas. And the team that won an international competition on this was actually a team that put together a way for investors to make money by putting money into watersheds, specifically in California.
Mm. I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because it talks about the payback on investment. So it's the Haas Business School.
As most of you know, I'm an economist by training, and I have, from the very beginning of the early stages of negotiating what became Chapter 8, I viewed it as these monies are an engine for innovative thinking, and you guys can make that happen. You need to transform that $2.7 billion into an incentive for being innovative about how we do co-equal goals and for that matter, groundwater sustainability over the long term.
Commissioner Horst.
I'd like to pursue a little bit more Commissioner Curtin's comments about some type of a resolution or a policy direction statement out of this commission that encourages and details a little bit further this integration concept. And I'm also particularly struck by Tim's suggestion that we should develop a statewide vision before we get into the weeds and look at projects by projects, mm-hmm. having spent most of yesterday morning absolutely in the weeds. We were in the roots of the roots of the tributaries of the weeds. So I think as we think about this, and a lot of this question and conversation has kind of started to frame some of that vision in a lot more detail than just we should integrate more. With respect to the flood management, for example, there is a tremendous amount of work going on locally that is wrapped around changing the way flood projects are managed and looking at off-stream recharge capacity. There's actually a new amount of work that's being done on a concept of on-farm flood water utilization, where local flood management agencies, mine, are proposing to buy easements to be able to put flood water for flood management and groundwater recharge. And I think those are things that we can incorporate into a visionary statement, along with this upper watershed component and even reservoir reoperation. So I think as we think about these things and try to communicate more formally to the public, let's wrap those kinds of details into that visionary document.
Just in regards to the resolution that I hope we prepare for next meeting, perhaps we should put a little group together to give some guidance to what we're looking at. But my original concept was really heavily towards integration of projects. But I the more I thought about it, I also don't want to discourage people from applying with individual projects, because just politically or pragmatically speaking, if I really feel comfortable that my project is a worthwhile project and it ends up being hooked up with another project, I may not get my project. So I don't want to discourage people to put their projects in as individual projects, but also as a package or a suite of projects that gives us the opportunity to support the whole package as opposed to just one piece or another piece of it. But I also don't want to preclude the possibility of their project going forward without it being integrated. I just don't know.
That makes a lot of sense.
We definitely need to put out the word that we are looking for integrated system-wide type of projects.
Commissioner Daniels.
There we go. So I agree with the comments about, in particular, about conveying the interest in integration, but also crafting some sort of a larger vision as we work forward. And I'm just struggling right now in my mind as to how we might do that, thinking about the types of things that we've been looking at in our agenda so far. I'm not sure how to construct it, that we would have a discussion to be able to craft a statewide vision. But if we could think of some way to do it, particularly using the Stakeholder Advisory Committee for participation in that, that's a large request of them. But maybe we could at least get started on a path toward that, how that might look, and start putting the frame of that together. I think it would help us feed all these other more discrete type decisions into that vision. And I'd like to see one as well.
Commissioner Herrera.
Yes, I agree, and I think if we are going to put together a committee of commissioners, I would like to be part of that committee. Particularly also, I'm very interested in further defining the vision for how we're going to achieve the water quality benefits as well. I was trying to go through the report, and I didn't quite see that. I'm sure it was implied when you mentioned, water supply reliability, but I think that particularly the water quality, I think we have a really great opportunity to be innovative and think of other approaches beyond what we probably have done. And I was wondering if AQUA and its stakeholder group has given thought on that particular item, water quality, and what recommendations you have for us.
I think it's one of those things that we would like to learn more about. Water quality is certainly not left out of Chapter 8. It is a potentially important public benefit that could drive some projects. So, again, if you're a project proponent and can figure out a way to solve some water quality problems out there consistent with that provision in the legislation, I think you're strongly motivated to do it, and it's got to be part of that integration that we're talking about. I agree.
Yeah, it'd be good to be thinking about what sort of recommendations we can be giving or guidance to the project proponents to be able to achieve those benefits. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you. It was a very broad and comprehensive presentation that you gave us. A lot of important things here that there's a lot of moving pieces that we have to somehow tie together, which you have made a very great suggestion on. I also want to thank you for the suggestions of our roles as a commission and our responsibilities and what we have to do. So we appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next slide.
Don't have any comment cards? Okay. We go to the next agenda item, which will be a briefing on the human right to water and environmental justice with Debbie Davis-Franco.
Good morning. My name again is Debbie Davis-Franco, and I am the Community and Rural Affairs Advisor and Local Drought Liaison at the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. And first, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this important issue. I do want to point out in advance that I am not a lawyer, so I'll be sharing with you some policy information around human right to water, but the main charge is for you all to take the information and then to go through the process and make the considerations. The human right to water was signed by the governor in 2012. And basically, it states that it's a priority of, or it's a policy of the state, I'm sorry, a policy of the state that everyone should have access to clean, affordable, and accessible water for basic human needs. And the action phrase is that it requires all relevant state agencies to consider the human right to water when revising, adopting, establishing, or establishing policies, regulations, and grant criteria. So I'm here today because you all are considering grant criteria. Basically, well, and I also, and thank you, thanks to your staff for attaching two really helpful documents. One is a document that was prepared by some legal folks at UC Berkeley, and it's a really excellent tool. And the other is a document, I think it says draft on it, but it is final. It's a guidance document that the Resources Agency distributed to provide guidance to agencies that are implementing Prop 1 programs. I'm going to focus mostly on the second document, which is the guidance document that the Resources Agency distributed. The main action phrase is consider. And our guidance document doesn't go into a lot of detail about what that means. The UC Berkeley document does. So if you're interested in more detail on the sort of the legal ramifications or the legal interpretations of what it means to consider, you should reference that document. But the document that Resources Distributed does provide some information about how you might go about analyzing the potential relationship between the program that you're administering and human right to water. I won't go into too much detail, but basically the main question is, does the action that you're engaging in have any relationship to the access to water for basic human needs in California? And so you might find that there's a direct relationship if there's some way that the program that you're funding could provide access to safe water to communities that currently don't have it. You might find that there's an indirect relationship where you might conceivably imagine that the program you're funding could do things like clean up water that a community might be able to access who doesn't already have an access to safe drinking water. And you might also consider whether or not your program will fund projects that could be designed to provide some direct or indirect benefit. And all of those are things that should be part of your process moving forward. And you all are the appropriate folks to make those decisions. The other two key things I would point out about the guidance document is that one of the key elements is that the process be transparent. and that you make some final declaration in writing. This is partly just so that we can, you know, when folks come and ask us, well, what happened? Why didn't Water Commission include human right to water? There's something clear that we can point to that says they did consider it, and this is hypothetical, of course. They did consider it, and here's their explanation for either why it didn't apply or how it applied and how they dealt with it. That we're asking all the agencies to do that, and hopefully as you post your guidance, your guidelines on the Drought Accountability webpage, that'll be part of what you report out. So that we can be clear and transparent with the public about how we're implementing the human right to water. And then the second thing is the importance of public participation. And when it comes to human right to water, your scope of public participation might be a little different than when you're focused narrowly on the elements of your funding program. You want to make sure that if you've determined that there is any relationship between human right to water and the program that you're administering, that you're reaching out to the community members that are actually impacted and making sure that they have an opportunity to talk with you and to express their opinions and views about how your program could impact them. And so there are a number of elements of advice within the guidance document that you might consider as you design that public outreach process. There are a number of tools across state agencies. This is not new, actually. Even with Human Right to Water in 2012, we've been prioritizing access to safe water in the state for a number of years. And so the State Water Board and the Department of Water Resources both have engaged on many levels in this issue and are full of tools and resources you might consider if you decide that this is an issue that is appropriate to your funding program. There are environmental justice liaisons in many of the agencies who have direct experience doing outreach and helping their departments and programs to understand environmental justice impacts and to design appropriate outreach strategies. The nonprofit world is, there are a number of NGOs out there that are very active and on the front, ahead of the curve on all of this that can be very helpful partners as you do this outreach. The Water Board is also developing a safe drinking water strategy currently, and you may be interested in getting information about what that strategy looks like to determine whether or not there are appropriate interfaces between their strategy and your funding program. They also maintain a list of communities that have water quality impairments. And so as you're focusing on whether or not your program has the potential to impact human right to water, you should definitely consider where those communities are located in relationship to where you expect to fund projects. And then we have a drought response ongoing, and there are a number of data resources that are available related to the drought response that will help you to identify where communities are entirely out of water who may benefit. I would also take one slight step back and point out that we both are looking at where we can help to achieve the human right to water, but we're also looking at opportunities to avoid negative impacts on people's ability to access safe drinking water. So that's another piece of the set of considerations that you should make. Generally speaking, I think the value of having the human right to water on our books, it's in Section 106 of our state water code, which is very sort of overarching policy section of our water code. And what it really does is it gives us as a state the opportunity to really be creative and strategic about using the variety of resources and programs that we have across all of our state agencies to help to achieve the greater outcome, which is ultimately to ensure that everyone in the state can access basic resources. So as you're considering, there are a few things that I would suggest, and again, your legal folks should give you good advice on the specifics of how you do this, but one thing, I wanted to reference something Tim said because I think it's ingenious. The idea that this program is an engine for innovative thinking, I would hope that you would put that same engine to work in thinking innovatively about how these investments have the potential to either influence other spending or create new opportunities to access water resources or a whole host of things, and again, or to avoid potential negative impacts on communities' ability to access safe drinking water. In your case, you might consider whether or not the human right to water will influence how you make your award, so whether it will influence your grant criteria. That seems like a fairly safe place to focus. It's a little trickier because what you're able to fund is clearly articulated in the bond language. And so you kind of have to ask yourselves whether or not there's a place in which this concept of human right to water fits under the rubric of public benefits. And I will definitely leave that to your lawyers to help you work through. But that's whether or not you can fund, whether or not your dollars could go to fund those benefits will be wrapped up in that analysis. And then I also, I also just wanted to tie back into the previous conversation where you were discussing the upper watershed. I think that's a perfect example of the similar kind of conversation you might have about human right to water, where your dollars are not necessarily going to be the dollars that fund those investments, but they're certainly critical to the overall landscape that you're looking at in making sure that our system is functioning statewide in an efficient way. And you might consider having conversations about how your process could also influence things like access to human right to water in the same kind of rubric. I think that's what I have. I'm happy to take any questions.
Anybody? Yep. Yes, Commissioner Daniels.
Okay. Managing the microphone. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Thank you. I actually first have a question for staff, and I'm wondering if someone on staff could respond. I was looking at our timeline and the different categories of analysis that we've had from the presentation of yesterday, and I'm wondering if you might have some thoughts about where in the process or how you might fit in, I guess, to the rules, the concepts that Debbie just raised, particularly a statement maybe from the applicant about how the project might impact communities of need in a certain region. I'm being vague in my language because I don't have it quite sorted out, but I'm wondering if you had a chance to reflect on it. If not, maybe we could get some thoughts at another time. And then we'll come back. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, of course, it's something that we are currently considering and where to apply it. And we have been working with Maureen as Commission Counsel and the Counsel from State Water Resources Control Board and how and if it can be applied to the public benefits. Certainly a place that we can include considerations for human right to water is the program objectives. And on the July issue working session, we'll be bringing back the goals, objectives, and principles document to the commission for consideration of suggestions and comments received. And I think we can discuss at that point of including a human right to water objective for funding projects.
I think it would have to be, my guess is it would have to be unpacked kind of specifically rather than just stating how are you meeting the human right to water, right? We'd have to be very clear about what that means.
We certainly have to consider it, and project proponents certainly have to consider it when they're formulating their projects.
Uh-huh.
But right now, council is looking into how it fits into the public benefits, and that is something that's currently ongoing, so we don't have an answer to that. They're looking specifically into public trust resources and how water quality for human consumption may be considered under that specific public benefit area.
One of the things that I'm struck by in Debbie's comments was the transparency in the process as well as public participation and identifying communities of need and so forth. So I'm wondering if it's something that we could ask for information on in terms of the process of the applicant in terms of their the people that they're looking at and working with and participating with, without it necessarily being the criteria for funding.
Yes, yeah, we can certainly do that.
And then the other question I have is technical assistance, because that was something Debbie raised also. So is there consideration being given for technical assistance?
Certainly, there's consideration for technical assistance and something we plan to provide. I don't think we've considered specifically technical assistance on applying Human Right to Water, so that's something staff will have to go back and discuss.
Okay. And then we'll hear back again at some point on that.
Yeah, we can definitely bring this issue back when staff has maybe a more formalized proposal for how to consider and incorporate Human Right to Water.
Okay, thank you.
Also, I'll add one more thing. Debbie will be coming to our Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting in June, and we'll be talking about Human Right to Water and how to apply it to the program at that meeting. So that's it's definitely on our radar.
Okay, thank you.
Just a quick question.
Yes, Commissioner Herrera.
Great. I'm glad to hear that we will be bringing back that, you know, legal recommendation and open it up to get public input. I think that's very important. I was wondering whether you mentioned that you have the various state agencies have, you know, liaisons. Is it feasible to ask them that maybe they can also assist us in making sure that they reach out to, you know, the folks that they're working with to make sure that they're part of the process at that point when we have the legal recommendations so that they can be inclusive then? I personally am very interested in seeing if we can make it be part of the grant criteria. So look forward to continue to work with the agencies and NGOs to see if we can get more participation beyond participation of those from the stakeholder group. And thank you for coming. Very informative.
Yeah, and I would just say Arsenio Mataka at Cal EPA, I believe, has a list of all the environmental justice liaisons that he could share with the commission.
Okay. Commissioner Curtin.
Thank you for the presentation. Really, really coherent. First, I want to state that the vision goals and or vision, goals, principles, and objectives that are coming back, we've kind of worked on that. That's sort of the fundamental, the foundation for our vision statement, I believe. And when that comes back, the people who weren't here originally should take a hard look at that, because it's what I've been working off of, trying to figure out how to sort of think through this thing. And it's not quite as you know, you think of a vision statement as a couple of paragraphs. It's a little bit more elaborate, but it covers a lot of the statutory requirements and the things that we really have to include. And if I'm not mistaken, the State Water Resources Control Board is really, really involved in the issue of communities that are losing their water and their groundwater and the contaminated groundwater and that sort of thing. We are under obligation, statutorily and otherwise, to keep in touch with them, and I would recommend that they, I mean, rather than us reinvent the wheel and try to figure this stuff out, they really have it, and they're bringing water. We could have somebody report to us, or certainly a mechanism where they identify and send us the information we can use. And as part of the thought process I've been going through, trying to connect all of the pieces as that are possible in a project. A project proponent doesn't really naturally gravitate to thinking through the overall scheme of things. But when we put our statement out perhaps next month, it should include as many potential objects and not limited to, but one of them would be distressed communities. And the proponents that I've spoken to, and there's a few in the audience, I think the message that was brought here should help them think through their projects, particularly those that are geographically in close location to distressed areas, how their project might be used either in emergency circumstances or just a general improvement in the water situation as part of this overall project that, again, goes from, you know, the groundwater and the distressed communities all the way up flood control, you know, the storage, upper watershed management. That's the sort of the package that I'm thinking through when I talk to proponents. Your project sounds really good, but is there a way you can hook it up with other projects in the region so that you become more than just one project and that the sum of the projects is greater than each individual? And that should be definitely a part of it. I mean, there are areas and projects that actually lend themselves more to it because they are, these communities are located in some areas, generally speaking. There's a geographic basis to some of them. And the projects in those areas really need to think through how to incorporate a potential solution for that problem. So thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, Debbie. We do have a comment from one of the folks in the audience. I'd like to call up Omar Carrillo.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Omar Carrillo, Senior Policy Analyst with the Community Water Center. I want to thank Debbie for the great presentation and for the commission for listening, actually taking this issue up and talking about it constructively. Bottom line is, on a very basic level, there's been tens of billions of dollars for water projects that the state public resource has put out, and yet we still have upwards of a million people who lack safe drinking water. Not affordable, not access, but safe drinking water. So at the end of the day, the Human Right to Water was passed in 2012, and really it set the stage for the water bond conversations. You know, there's a lot of conversation over what the goal of the water bond Prop 1 should be. The reality of it is that 2012, Human Right to Water happened, and the conversations that were a lot of the focus was on the human right to water when the various chapters in the water bond were shaped. So it's very important that in making the decisions here and the resources that you have, that this commission is taking issue on or talking about and deliberated on, specifically the IRWIP money, the groundwater resources, the resources on storage. I mean, the human right to water is considered, and most definitely in respect to shaping the guidelines for how the resources will be distributed, the human right to water definitely has to be considered, and we appreciate the recommendations in that direction. And what I'll say is that with respect to the drought, and there's two other issues that I probably won't be here to talk about, which is one is a report on the drought and IRWIMS. Not that I'm talking about that, but bottom line is that there is a great opportunity here with Prop 1 to really focus on the most disadvantaged communities, the most the communities that need this resource the most, and the human right to water focuses on accessibility, affordability, and safety, really. And so at the end of the day, we appreciate staff's take on incorporating some criteria that will work towards establishing the human right to water, and also the commission's leadership on this issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It might be a good idea if we could find out where some of these hot spots are. We've heard of some, like East Porterville and Monson and Three Rocks. So I don't know whether we could get some information on some of these communities that have been impacted.
Commissioner Debolsky, may I respond to that?
Yes.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. What I can tell you right now is that you have a situation where there's only maybe one county, that's Tulare County, that's collecting the information on private well failures, like domestic well failures. And so we need a proper accounting of those who have lost their domestic water source. I can tell you that with certainty. So if we have, you know, there's a conversation over 2,000 well failures, of which most of them are in Tulare, but the reality of it that there might be thousands more. That's what we think. We just don't have proper accounting. So in terms of the hotspots, wholeheartedly agree with you. And I know that DWR does have $5 million that was made available to the drought resource funding that they will be administering, and that's focused on private wells. So there is a direct need for that, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. That'd be great.
Yeah, there are even some communities that are dependent on surface water. They got no surface water. Mm-hmm. And when they, you know, found some water, it was too expensive for them. And the community couldn't afford it. So it would be a good idea to learn more about some of these impacted areas. So, yes, Commissioner Ira.
I know, Debbie, you mentioned that the state has data on the websites. I'd be curious to see if you think it would be a good idea to maybe have somebody from those websites to come and that's managing the website and collecting the data give us sort of an overview of where the impacts are, and maybe we could work. I know some of us work at the local level and can maybe help make sure that that data is as accurate as possible. I know that the state has been trying to encourage, you know, all counties to report, and I hope that that's been improved since our earlier conversations, but it's been a while since I've looked at that. So I'm just curious if you think that data has improved and whether it makes sense to have people, you know, come and give us sort of an overview conditions of where the impacts are and where we have greater opportunity.
Okay. Commissioner Orth.
I should have raised my hand.
Pardon me? Did you want Debbie to respond to that? Do you want to respond to that, Debbie? Sorry.
Yes, actually, and actually there are more than Tulare County is reporting to the state on the dry wells. And we at OPR actually are housing that data, but we have a number of data sets that would be relevant, and I'm sure we could pull together the range of agencies that would be necessary to pull together all the information that we have.
I was just going to suggest that as we gather additional information, and it's critical that the commission understands the scope and magnitude of this, we have the absolute short-term disaster of failed wells and the equally significant disaster of unsafe drinking water that we're trying to get our arms around, and it's incredibly large in scope. I think we all know that, and yet we don't know how large. So as we gather information, I also think the commission would benefit from an understanding of where the other financial resources are available to deal with this. There's money administered through the State Water Resources Control Board. There's also a significant investment, as the point was made earlier, within other chapters of Prop 1 that I think the commission should be aware of. That doesn't diminish our responsibility to consider the issue with respect to Chapter 8 funding, but I think it would be helpful to all of us to see the amounts of money that are available for other from other sources.
Commissioner Orth, can I respond real quick? What I was going to mention is the $5 million that is so private well resource for DWR, there's a similar like pot cleanup and abatement at the State Water Board that also is focused. So some synergies there would be incredible. So that way there's some collaboration and proper understanding, and that'd be a great step in the right direction.
Okay. Thank you, Omar. Okay. If there's no other questions, we'll move on to the next item, which should be a briefing on NASA JPL Airborne Snow Observatory. Thomas Painter.
Getting the movie loaded. Hope.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to come talk. I'm going to tell you about a program that DWR, in concert with NASA, has invested in over the last 3 years, and in particular, Frank Gerke, the chief of the California Cooperative Snow Surveys, has been an integral part of this project. I think you know the motivation for this. The about 70% of the fresh water precipitation in California comes from snowfall, and in the Colorado River Basin, about 65 to 70% of that water supply comes from snowfall. This is the way that we've known the mountain snowpack since about 1910, which is through the use of the federal sampler, and every April 1st, you see Frank out there at South Lake Tahoe making that measurement. This goes on across the Sierra, and then in the 1980s there was the addition of the snow pillow, And this map shows the distribution of snow pillows and snow courses, which has the appearance of looking rather complete. But when we zoom in, then we can see that even though these dots, which are snow pillows and snow courses, look to be fairly large, they're exaggerated in scale by 3,600. So there's a dramatic undersampling. Those sites were really there for as index sites, as an indicator of what was in the mountain snowpack, but not as a full accounting. If we look at the Tuolumne Basin here above Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, you can see some of the red dots on the screen. Those, again, are expanded 3,600 times. That's the way that we see the snowpack right now, when there's snow on the snow pillows and at the snow courses. This is the way that we want to see the snowpack. We want to have that full quantification. And so that really motivates the project and the investment by DWR and NASA headquarters, in particular to go after the magnitude and timing of snowmelt runoff. And to do that, you need to know the two main things: the snow water equivalent, that full spatial distribution of how much water there is in the mountain snowpack, and then the snow albedo, the reflectivity. It turns out that controls how fast the mountain snowpack melts out. About 90 to 95% of the energy that goes to melting snow is absorbed sunlight. So the program, the Airborne Snow Observatory, is a combination of a scanning LIDAR, which is a high-frequency laser pointer. If you could run your thumb 800,000 times a second, that's what the laser does. The dual laser system does on the aircraft. And then we also have an imaging spectrometer immediately behind that, which measures the reflected sunlight from the snowpack in about a 1 square meter area completely across the basin in about 100 different colors. That gives us the indication of what's controlling the snow melt, what's controlling that snow albedo. An important part of this is the 24-hour turnaround of the products. Many research projects hold on to their data and then they turn them around in a few months. But to make this immediately relevant in this partnership with DWR, I gave my team the mandate that we will turn those products around in 24 hours from the time that we land. The main products that we have coming out of this are the snow depth distribution at 1.5 square meter resolution, 3 meter and 50 meters, snow water equivalent as well, and then the snow albedo, that reflectivity. This also allows us to do a full quantification of snowfall, and it leads then to much improved allocations, runoff forecasting. So in particular, this program has been going on for the last 3 years, which has all been in drought. One of the great opportunities for this, though, is flood mitigation and quantification along those lines and having that complete information. We hope that one of these years we will start getting snowfall again so that we can make use of that. This is how it works. Just in the interest of time, I'll move on. These are some of the products. These are fully generated from the topography, comes from the scanning LIDAR, and the color here comes from the imaging spectrometer. This is the reflectivity. So you can see that very detailed presentation of the reflectivity, which also tells us the absorptivity, how fast it's going to melt. And then finally, the big nugget here is the spatial distribution of snow depth and snow water equivalent. And this is the kind of detail that we've never had possible. How accurate? Our depth uncertainties are about 2 centimeters. So it's quite accurate considering we have an aircraft that's bumping around flying above the mountains. This is what the products look like. This is the full spatial distribution of snow water equivalent for the Tuolumne Basin above Hetch Hetchy. And this is where I hope that the movie will work. But it looks like I'm going to need to escape. Yeah, but I'm looking for the movie that we just pulled out.
Isn't the thumb drive?
Ah, okay. All right. What this movie is going to show you is the time series in 2013. And let's see. Okay. Apparently it doesn't work on the PC. So my apologies. But what I would be showing you is the time series, the weekly maps. So this program does a weekly acquisition over the Tuolumne Basin, the Merced, the Kings, Middle Fork, and South Fork, the Lakes Basin over by Mammoth, and Rush Creek, which then flows off into Mona Lake. And from that information, then, we can have that complete time series of not only those maps showing the distributions, but also the full quantification for the total snow water equivalent in the mountain basin. We have been working with the Hetch Hetchy operation on the runoff forecasting, and the modeling that's being implemented by DWR right now throughout the state is the USGS Precipitation Runoff Modeling System, the PRMS. And in the absence of the Airborne Snow Observatory information, there are non-trivial errors still in the forecasting of runoff. Whereas when we bring in the information, that proper quantification of the mountain snowpack, then it much reduces those forecast errors. Likewise, when we look at the April through July runoff, we know that that because we don't do that full accounting of the mountain snowpack with the snow pillars and the snow courses, that forecast of the AJRO is going to be problematic. And this figure just shows that about 50% of the time we're up to 20% errors in those forecasts, and then 20% of the time those April through July runoff forecasts are up to 40 and greater percent off. So we really want to reduce that error. This is a scatter plot that was put together from an analysis by the Hetch Hetchy team for the city of San Francisco, looking at the 2013 and 2014 data from ASO. And it is on the y-axis is the inflow from the date of the airplane's acquisition over the basin. And the x-axis here is the full quantification of the basin snowpack. So in other words, how predictive of the inflow from that date through July 1st, could have gone to July 31st, but there was little flow in those drought years. How predictive is that of the total flow that's coming? And you can predict it with an R-square of 0.98. They spent a week looking at these data just to make sure that they weren't just plotting one ASO product against another, because they were quite surprised at the robustness. These are just some of the quotes from the water managers that we've been working with. What you're doing there with ASO is creating new reservoirs without need for lawsuits and environmental impact statements. And I'm seeing these data are going to let me finally sleep well, knowing the forecasts are now accurate. Commissioner Orth, that came from a buddy of yours. So on the left is the program as it is right now. And so the red outline there by Mono Lake, that's the Tuolumne Basin. Just below that is the Merced, the Lakes Basin down below. And then you can see the Kings down below with a target on it and a whole bunch of yellow boxes. That's because it's in a military operation area. So we have delicate dances getting in there to fly. But still, we've been managing to do so on a roughly weekly basis. And I'll just point out that we have active engagements not only with DWR, but also the city of San Francisco, Kings River with Steve Haugen, and Southern California Edison in Rush Creek, and then the Mammoth Lakes Water District, Pat Hayes over there. So those are very active collaborations. Where we're headed, so we're working on the plans for full implementation for the Sierra Nevada, working on this with DWR, and also doing a cost-benefit analysis, working with the stakeholders to determine what the value of this information is to them. And the plan here on the right would have us essentially have a clear day. We would deploy most likely 3 aircraft that would fly the entire Sierra Nevada among them. You would have a complete snapshot of what that mountain snowpack is, and then that would feed into the modeling framework that's being developed. Now, do we want to get rid of the ground measurements? Absolutely not. The ground measurements are going to be critical to calibrating what we have on the ground and informing it. The snow density information, the networks that are being developed at UC Merced and other institutions at Berkeley, that information will be really key in this integrated framework. The other piece that I wanted to point out is that in the far upper left, on the left figure, is the outline of the King Fire. And we flew that for NASA and for the Forest Service in January. We've also been flying parts of the Rim Fire regularly, the Rim Fire SCAR, and we're poised for what's likely going to be an active fire season this year, unfortunately. We're also in discussions with the Forest Service right now about the fact that we have these flights regularly on a weekly basis. That gives us tremendous information from the LIDAR and the spectrometer on the health of forests, forest density, forest mortality, response to the drought. And so this is not only a wintertime and springtime activity, but it also can spill over into the rest of the year. That is all I have.
I have a question. What is this is all very useful information, and I see that science is advancing where we can get better information. What does this tell us about the upper watershed management? Does it give us any indication of what we're doing and if we're doing the right things, or what can you tell? What does it tell us about that?
Well, so it's been an interesting process to go from the very sparse measurements that we've used for a century to all of a sudden having spatially complete information and very accurate quantification. So there was some scratching of heads immediately on this, and then the water managers have gotten to work on how to implement this information. But one of the things that's absolutely clear is that the snow pillows and the snow courses tend to be at lower elevations, and as the season progresses, they lose their utility, and they migrate toward a period where the managers are blind to the upper watershed. The other is that in that lack of knowledge about the accurate information in the high elevation snowpack, there's a lot of hedging that goes on in the water management to be conservative against what might happen, and that introduces inefficiencies in the system. Ultimately, that can lead to downstream users, junior water rights holders, not getting their water that they may well have been able to get if there was a more quantitative management of the water informed by this kind of information and integrated framework. It's been an interesting exercise in these last couple of years with the city of San Francisco and with Steve Haugen, the water master for the Kings River, on how they use that information. And with one having distribution of allocations to deal with, he looks at it in a different way from what the city of San Francisco does. They have one, essentially one pot that they work toward, and he's looking at a more distributed group of stakeholders and clients. And so it is emerging the various ways that this information can be used.
Thank you. Commissioner Quintero.
My understanding is that with the climate change that we're seeing, one of the things that is happening is that we're seeing more snow falling at the higher elevations and less snow falling at sort of that rain-snow interface. So what you're doing is able to really track those sorts of changes, which is really critical. And I also am aware of some studies recently that are showing that, surprisingly, temperatures, air temperatures at the highest elevations are actually increasing at a faster rate than air temperatures in the middle elevations. So there's a lot of dynamism going on that your work is able to really get a good handle on. And, you know, the power of, you know, I said earlier to Tim Quinn that what we really need is better water forecasting and being able to utilize these tools and the mix of tools, because as you know, Etmer said, there's a lot of groundwork going on, but together, I think these information systems are going to be invaluable to the state in terms of understanding what we're going to be able to manage. So thank you so much for this presentation.
Thank you. Any other questions?
You got any room on this plane?
You know, so we are presently working in a non-pressurized aircraft, but we're migrating this fall to a pressurized aircraft, in which case we can take commissioners on the plane. We can't presently. So it's a fantastic view, and we would love to do that, to be able to show you the operations of this program. We also, it looks that we are going to be going, potentially going to fly in Nepal in the fall to do the full quantification of all of the earthquake-affected regions. It has that diversity of opportunity. Hopefully we won't have to do the same thing in California anytime soon.
Well, and with what Tim Quinn's...
Yeah.
No, I mean, what's happening in California right now has impact for the world in terms of the work that we're all doing. And it's very cool that you're going to Nepal and doing that work, because I know that these technologies have worldwide implications.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas.
All right.
No comment cards, so we'll move on to item. Ten. And we'll have an update on drought conditions and drought funding from Janine Jones.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. I wish I were the bearer of better news, but that isn't usually why I come before you. So this is a look at our average percent of average precipitation to date. The one good news item in here would be simply that it's better than where we were last year, but that is not exactly a great consolation. We are at least above 50% of average in many areas of the state, with the exception of some of the important San Joaquin Valley watersheds. In terms of our Northern Sierra precipitation, we're at about 3/4 of average for the important basins that feed into the Sacramento River system. And on the San Joaquin, not doing as well, a little under half of average. In terms of statewide temperatures, it's been very warm, and obviously that was the thing that wiped out our snowpack this winter. So as a result of not having any of that snowpack that Tom was just talking about, we have less inflow to fill our reservoirs. And one of the important things that we're watching very closely is the condition of statewide reservoir storage. As you can see, many of our major reservoirs are certainly below average for this state, although trying to put a positive spin on things, this isn't as bad as we were in 1977. So I guess you can look at it in that perspective. Now, very low runoff forecasts because of that lack of snowpack. Obviously, these are not good numbers, and that pretty much means that what we have in the reservoirs now is what we have to live with as we go through the summer months. And reservoir operators are very closely thinking about things such as holding back the water that they'll need, for example, to meet cold water requirements for salmon later in the year, and also critical urban health and safety needs. Our water supplies for the big water projects essentially unchanged from when I last spoke to you. State Water Project allocation 20%, 0% for many of the Central Valley Project's agricultural customers, including a zero, second year in a row for many of them. The Colorado River remains our bright spot in terms of statewide water supply conditions. You may have been hearing in the news about the prospects of future shortage in the Colorado River. That's getting increasingly likely that we may see a first ever shortage in the lower basin in 2016 or 2017. However, California does not share in that shortage because of seniority of water rights, but it's certainly a wake-up call for everyone in the lower basin, and it's a day that we've expected would come sooner or later. So as you know and you've heard before, we've been very busy in drought response actions, most recently the governor's executive order last month, continuing many of the prior measures and adding a greatly increased emphasis on conservation. Specifically asked to mention funding, so just a few brief overview points here. So last year, as you recall, we did have the first tranche, if you will, of emergency drought relief legislation. And the single largest chunk of that, just under $550 million, basically was from bond funds for the IRWM activities funded by Prop 84. And Tracy will be following later on the agenda to talk about what they've been doing with those grant programs. Then, once again, this March, we had another emergency funding measure pass. And remember that this would now be after the voter approval of Proposition 1 in November. So the March measure accelerated some of the Proposition 1 funding, particularly for the State Water Resources Control Board. Although actually about two-thirds of the money in the March emergency relief legislation was for the flood control side because it was also accelerating the flood control side of Prop 1. And, while we certainly don't wish for big floods next year, often we see our droughts are ended by a very wet year, so that prospect always remains before us. After the flood monies, the largest pot of funding in the March measure was the Prop 1 fundings, particularly going to the State Water Resources Control Board. Did want to mention, since the prior speaker mentioned it, that we at DWR did get $5 million for that very small communities private well owner program as an emergency response program. And I'll get back to that one in a minute. And then you have a copy of the summary pages of the May revise in your budget with respect to the drought provisions. And this is just a summary table of what's in there. And as indicated on the table, some of these are augmentations over what was in the governor's earlier budget proposal in January, and some of them are new items. And as you can see here, the State Water Resources Control Board has a lion's share of this funding here. Most of the DWR funding comes with respect to the water and energy conservation programs funded by cap and trade monies. Did want to point out, and maybe this is a good place to mention about the emergency funding, since the prior speaker talked about the looking at synergies between state agency programs. I'd like to mention that we're working very closely with the State Water Resources Control Board in how they are able to administer the funds available to them through the Safe Drinking Water Act program and how we're administering our emergency funds. For example, there are some things that in statute the state board cannot fund with Safe Drinking Water Act funds. We may have the capability under this emergency funding to step in, and you will see a project for a particular community having two state agencies funding different pieces of it based on the statutory authorizations associated with the funding source. So we're coordinating very closely with the State Water Resources Control Board on these measures. So you've seen this slide before, just some of the big ticket things that we've been working on, everything from our ongoing operations of the State Water Project, our financial assistance programs, a lot of new activity in groundwater monitoring in response to implementation of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. and just wanted to highlight the one new thing since your last meeting, and that was the installation of the emergency salinity control barrier at West False River in the Delta. As you may know, back in 1977, the department installed barriers in many locations in the Delta to try and manage salinity conditions there without having to release any more water than necessary from upstream reservoirs to try and conserve that reservoir storage in the event that next year is dry and we would really need it. So this year it's come down to the installation of the one temporary barrier at West False River. It is will be removed in November to provide for salmon passage. And total cost of install and removal is probably a little under $30 million is the estimate, so it's not an inconsequential project, but it's important for managing water quality conditions for diverters within the Delta, as well as allowing us to preserve water in storage in the event that next year is dry. So that was the highlights. Happy to answer questions if there are any.
Commissioner Quintero.
My understanding is that in 1977 there were seven temporary dams that were put up in the Delta.
There was a lot of plumbing in the Delta, including all of those temporary barriers and some emergency pipelines that were constructed to move water around from one place to another, and that was also part of the emergency pipeline project to get water to Marin, actually, through a connection with East Bay Mud. So there was a lot of emergency plumbing then.
Commissioner O'Hara.
Hi, thank you for coming. I actually have a few questions. just a simple one. The $5 million, is that the source? Was that Prop 1 or is that general funding?
General.
You mentioned that the DWR is coordinating with the State Water Resource Control Board. What does that mean? Can you define that further? Like, how are you guys coordinating, and how would a disadvantaged community or impacted community, how would they approach? Who should they approach? State Water Board, DWR? How can we make sure those funds go to them?
Actually, since these are funds that are coming to us through the emergency provisions, for emergency provisions, they really should talk to their county OES. That should be a main point of contact. And then through the regional OES offices, we coordinate very closely with them to identify areas. You know, Debbie mentioned this effort to track where problems are being experienced, to identify those areas, feed that information into us, and then we look at the problem in coordination with the State Water Board Drinking Water Program and see who has jurisdiction, who can fund what, and so forth. The State Water Resources Control Board, as you probably know, does not regulate under the Safe Drinking Water Act less than 15 connections. Those are the county area of responsibility to the extent that they are regulated. And, of course, less than five, not at all, and private well owners. So it's been quite a challenge to try and work with the counties to get some of them to get more involved and step up in this and provide the information to us so that we know where areas are experiencing problems. But information is starting to come in better. We also have a technical assistance contract with the California Rural Water Association, and we are trying to use that to also get early intelligence on some of these areas that are having problems, and we can have Cal Rural do on-site visits with these communities or water systems and help them prepare financial assistance applications, do water conservation plans, figure out what their next steps are.
My next question was going to be sort of what kind of projects are eligible for the $5 million and who's eligible?
It is basically an emergency response program, so it's not like a grant program so per se where there are eligibility criteria. Basically, the referrals to us through Cal OES or through the State Water Resources Control Board. The State Water Resources Control Board is taking the systems that are jurisdictional under the Safe Drinking Water Act, although we may be able to step in and assist behind them on a piece of a project that they may not be able to fund with the drinking water program, and we're getting the under 15s and private well owners.
Great. Yeah, that's a good point because I've worked, my personal job. We work with a lot of communities that are actually falling through the cracks right now, that are have been struggling for a year now to access any sort of state dollars. I think the only one that has sort of been even an option has been USDA, their emergency drought program. And we had heard about, you know, the $5 million that was granted to DBR and had no idea really what would the process even look like to help these communities assist them. One concern is, again, what type of solutions can you fund? We know that sometimes when it's emergency funding, maybe you can't do permanent solutions, and I think that that's something that's been very frustrating, because we do have communities that need permanent solutions, that need to be able to construct a distribution system in a community well, and that has been very challenging. And I was just wondering whether the funding that you have provides that flexibility to be able to fund permanent solutions such as construction of wells and distribution.
Yeah, the first option of choice, if it's possible, of course, is to try and do an interconnection to a more solvent system. If that's not possible, then yes, well drilling is a possibility.
And are there any potential projects that the department's already looking at funding with the $5 million?
We've had inquiries from, say, round numbers 10, 12 different entities so far. So, yes, I think, you know, as I'm sure you know, the need for this kind of resource far outweighs the funding levels. So that is always a challenge.
Is there a particular web page where we could... that you have designated to provide more information on this particular funding source that we could look more into, or is that currently being developed?
Actually, it would. I would suggest going through the OES webpage, drought.gov.
Okay.
We're trying to use OES as the point of contact for these kinds of problems.
Great. Thank you.
I'm kind of curious about the salinity barrier. Is that a temporary structure?
Oh, yes. It's basically a very large, expensive pile of rocks, an engineered very large, expensive pile of rocks. But, yes, it is a temporary barrier, and it's not unlike the ones that we put in for fishery purposes, like the Head of Old River Barrier, which we've installed for years. They simply come in, dump the rock in an engineered fashion, and then come back in the fall and remove it.
And if we have a drought next year, we'll probably do that again.
And we're planning to stockpile the rock on site in the event that happens. Hopefully we don't need to do it.
Is this different than the Two Gates project that was mentioned about 5 or 6 years ago?
Yes. And actually there have been many, many different ways of looking at barriers in the Delta for salinity purposes over the years, including gated barriers and other means of designing barriers so that recreational boater access is not limited. But since this is hopefully a temporary, as in not again next year, emergency barrier, it is the simple rock barrier as we do for the fishery ones every year.
And it's meant to protect the Delta from salinity and the conveyance of water and so forth.
Yeah, it's to protect some of the in-Delta diversions, whether it's Contra Costa's intake or agricultural diversions, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, having hopefully allowing us to not have to release as much water from storage. Part of the problem is that since this is such a dry year, in more average year conditions, if salinity problems were occurring, we would reduce our diversions at the pumps. Well, we're diverting so little at the pumps, we don't have any diversions to reduce at this point. So then you would otherwise have to make an upstream reservoir release to manage salinity.
I see. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Yes.
I've been debating about whether I should ask this or ask for a separate briefing, because I'm still getting up to speed on your groundwater program, and seeing the May revise and the budget that you have for the groundwater sustainability program made me think that I wanted more information on that. But I have a feeling that
go ahead and ask.
You all might have been briefed a lot, but could you give me the contours of what that program is? Part of what I'm looking for here too is that I imagine you are looking at a way to strategically assess the groundwater comprehensively throughout the state, and where there might be some benefits in terms of management, right?
Yeah, and actually, the 2009 legislation that created the CASGEM, California Statewide Elevation Monitoring Program, was instrumental in giving us a head start on this, because that mandated the reporting of water level data to DWR for the state's major groundwater basins. And as a result of having the CASGEM data, we went through a process of prioritizing which were the most important basins, if you will, and identified what were called the high, medium, and low priority basins. The low priority basins being alluvial basins, say, for example, out in the Mojave Desert on federal land ownership, where there's really not a lot of developed use, unlike our major basins in the San Joaquin Valley or some of the areas in Southern California's coastal plain. So when the SGMA legislation came along, one of the first to-do items in that legislation was actually some directives. The legislation directed both DWR and the state board to take certain actions. And one of the first actions that we had to take was related to identifying those basins that would be the subject of this exercise, if you will. And we essentially went with the prioritization that had been done for the CASGEM purpose, identifying those high and medium priority ones. And then that triggers a whole series of follow-up events, including an evaluation of boundaries of the basins that were identified to see if the boundaries that were identified in our Bulletin 118 document a couple of decades ago align with, say, modern adjudications and all of those other things. The gist of it, big picture, though, is that the state wants to empower and enable local agencies to manage the groundwater basin at a local level. The first step is forming a sustainable management entity, so a local agency joint powers authority or similar vehicle, which can then get together and prepare a plan for how to move forward. And the carrot and stick approach, of course, the stick being that if the local agencies don't come together and form a management entity of some kind, then the state may step in.
I think maybe I should ask for a separate briefing, because what I want to do is get a better sense of the prioritization and those efforts along those ways. So I'll just ask for that myself, because I think everybody here is kind of caught up on that. So if that's all right.
Yes, Commissioner Earth.
I guess I'd like to also add, for the benefit of the question, that DWR has just recently and is in the process over the next couple of months conducting some webinars to provide some updated information on groundwater conditions in the hydrologic regions. This, I think, is an extension of the California Water Plan update process from last year, and there's some really good information that shows kind of the evolution of our groundwater conditions by these major hydrologic regions. So that might be something you want to look at too.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, there are no comments for this item, so we'll go on to an update of the IRWM funding. Tracy Billington.
All right, thank you, Commissioners, for inviting me here. I'm going to give you a quick update on the Proposition 1 IRWM grant program, and I'll have a little bit on the Prop 84 grant program, too. So this is just a quick overview of the various pots from Proposition 1 that the department administers. And in response to Commissioner Daniels' question about the groundwater funding, there are $60 million from Proposition 1 that is proposed in the May revise. Of that, it is primarily is for a grant program, and the two items that we've identified initially were for well installations that could benefit the CASGEM program and groundwater planning program. There's also funding of $784 million for the state board out of Proposition 1 that is being proposed in the May revise also. But I will be focusing in on the IRWM grant program and not covering the other ones. But if you want briefings in the future on the other programs, we can do that. So this should be a familiar list to all of you. Here are the eligible applicants, and this applies, this list applies to all of Proposition 1, and the big change from Proposition 1 to prior bonds is the inclusion of federally recognized Indian tribes and state Indian tribes on the Native American Heritage Commission list. That is a new addition. And a couple of the definitions that are relevant to later slides is the disadvantaged community definition, which is 80% of the median household income. And based on the most recent American Community Surveys information, that's a income of around just under $49,000. Certain programs also have obligations for the severely disadvantaged communities, which is 60% of the median household income. And there are required cost shares of 50% for certain programs, and the programs also have the ability to waive or reduce the cost share for disadvantaged communities or economically distressed areas. And the department is responsible for making some determinations on whether a community meets the definition of economically distressed areas. My staff are working on developing tools that help us figure out what a financial hardship is, low population density, and also identifying what counties would be considered rural. So that's one of our up-and-coming activities. So on the IRWM grant program, so we have basically a slight difference between the general purposes that the funding was authorized in Proposition 1 from Proposition 84, and the Proposition 1 funding has definitely more of a water supply emphasis on it. And Proposition 84 also was clear on including water quality and water and the environment. So Proposition 84 was $1 billion, and it allocated it to 11 different funding areas. Proposition 1 is $510 million, and it allocated it to 12 different areas. I've got to quit doing this every time I start public speaking. I've slipped in a real quick slide on Proposition 84 because on last Wednesday, we released the final guidelines, and we are looking to award all the remaining funds from Proposition 84, which is $231 million. And the amount available to the funding areas ranges from $4 million to $64 million. And applications are due in August. And our goal is to have all the funds awarded by the end of the year. So for the general requirements for the Proposition 1 IRWM funding is we're looking at projects and priorities to projects in plans that cover a greater portion of the watershed. Groundwater plans are required, and we're looking that the plan contributes to the risk of the region for water supply and water infrastructure related to climate change. Someday if it starts raining and there's humidity in the air, I might not have these dry coughs. So there was in the proposition a list of eligible projects. This is an includes, but not. Yes.
Back to the slide before.
General requirements.
Yes.
That so, one?
This one?
No. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. General purpose. I'm looking at general requirements. Oh, okay. I'm a little ahead. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This one.
Yeah, but.
Yes, sir.
You don't have to. Well, I was just going to say it sounds similar to the things we've been talking about here. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar in terms of the general requirements. Priority plans cover a greater portion of the watershed. A groundwater plan required. That's kind of what I think I've been trying to encourage that we incorporate in our own approach. So we should be probably collaborating with the IRWM in general pretty carefully.
Yes, and since you have the IRWM team assisting you, I think there'll be some collaboration there. One of the things on the general requirements, just from, you know, somebody who's been doing this for a while,
The special consideration for multi-benefit projects is basically a lessening of the requirement, because in Proposition 84, it was mandated that the projects be special benefit, be multiple benefits. So that's just a little bit of trivia for you.
Do you mind if I ask then? So how does special consideration play itself out? Extra bonus points? I mean, how does it work?
Your favorite kid.
That is one of the things that we'll be working on. Or do we just say, you know, we like multiple benefit
projects
and we want to see multiple benefit projects?
Yeah.
Because I think it is, you know, most projects have multiple benefits to begin with. So this is a list of the type of projects we can fund. Since it's an includes but not limited to, we can have a broader definition. In the RWM Planning Act, there are other categories that are included that aren't specifically listed here. So, and I'm not sure whether obligation sounds pejorative, but here are the requirements that we have for our disadvantaged communities. So there is a required 50% non-state cost share that can be waived or reduced for projects that directly benefit a disadvantaged community or an economically distressed area. So the economically distressed area really comes into play when the 80% median household income metric doesn't work for a community that has that is economically distressed. There's also 10% of the funding, which is $51 million, for projects that directly benefit a disadvantaged community. And there is an additional 10%, or again, $51 million, to ensure the involvement of disadvantaged communities, economically distressed areas, and underrepresented communities within the regions. And that funding can be either directly expended or for non-competitive grants. And one of the things we're looking at is when we're advancing the program is really what should be included as involvement of disadvantaged communities. And we're hoping to have a very broad interpretation of that, so it is more than just facilitation and outreach. It's hopefully project formulation, needs assessments, and things along those lines. So our general concept is we're proposing a limited planning grant program. The budget has is proposing $5 million for planning, and we're really targeting it to those IRWM regions that have yet to develop an IRWM plan. We have made significant investments in IRWM planning through Propositions 50 and Propositions 84, and most of our IRWM regions have IRWM plans that are adopted and meet the current standards. So then we're looking at the disadvantaged community involvement and the disadvantaged community projects, and then an implementation grant program. It's two times $183 million for the amount of money for implementation. I am sorry for not having done the simple math. Our initial schedule is we're working on initial stakeholder and outreach engagements efforts. We have a tribal consultation meeting where the IRWM program, along with the Water Commission, will be having a tribal consultation in June. And we're developing a stakeholder and engagement advisory committee that will be comprised of members from the individual funding area, representatives from the funding area and disadvantaged community and tribal representatives to give us some initial input on how to develop the program. And we're hoping to have public scoping workshops in August after the submittal of the grant applications. We don't want to hold them before then because I'm thinking most of our stakeholders are busy working on their grant applications. And then we're looking to have guidelines out by the end of the year and starting administering the funds early next year, assuming that the funding is appropriated through the budget. And that's the end of my presentation. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Questions, anyone? Yes, Commissioner North.
Thank you, Tracy. Very helpful. When you look at the general concepts page, I guess I'm trying to understand what that's saying to me. There's specifically with respect to the Tulare Lake Hydrologic Region, there's $34 million available under the IRWM chapter. Is the concept here that would be broken down into these sub-program categories, and then whether it is or isn't, subject in addition to that, I guess I'm more interested in, or equally interested in, the second one, the involvement funding. What's contemplated there, given there's a history of involvement funding in that region already?
So basically, if you look at the bond overall and how the money is allocated to the 12 funding areas, and so there are two 10% obligations for disadvantaged community activities, the involvement and the projects. So you take your $34 million, and $3.4 million of that would have to go for involvement, and an additional $3.4 million would have to go to the disadvantaged community projects just to meet the minimum requirements of the proposition.
Of how it was written in the proposition.
Right.
Okay.
So then the remaining funding would go to implementation grants, but if there were any IRWM regions within the Tulare Basin that were coming in, could qualify for a planning grant program, that would come out of the $34 million. So one of the differences between Prop 84 and Prop 1 was we had the interregional money where we augmented the planning grant program with interregional funding. So any of the planning grant funds come out of the regional allocation.
That's helpful. I was not aware that there was a specific delineation of involvement funding within that chapter, so that answers
right.
the question.
So it is in that involvement funding applies only to the IRWM funding, not to the stormwater or the water conservation funding. They, too, have the 10% funding for disadvantaged communities.
Thank you.
The question?
Yes. Commissioner Herrera.
I had a question on technical assistance within the program, particularly for disadvantaged communities.
I think that's where we would fall under the involvement funding. There is no specific mandated technical assistance program, but again, we have 10% for involvement, and that gets into what is involvement. And I think that's the venue for taking care of technical assistance type activities, such as needs assessments, like I mentioned earlier.
So that's you're going to be seeking more input on how to develop those, it sounds like, in June, July. Is that
right?
Accurate? And then on the Stakeholder Engagement Advisory Committee, are those standing already organized committees, or is that?
This is really the first time we've daylighted it. I need to start making some phone calls when I get back to the office. So it's something that we're about to get up and moving.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Thanks.
Has there been any outreach process to reach these disadvantaged communities?
I think through, you know, the main outreach efforts have been through the IRWM regions. Mm-hmm. So we have a history through Proposition 84 of funding projects for disadvantaged communities, and we've had some legislative appropriation-based obligations. We also did a disadvantaged community assistance program. And you've heard previously about the Tulare Lake Basin Study. That was one of the activities that the IRWM program funded that provided a lot of assistance to the Tulare Lake Basin on the disadvantaged community needs. And then the individual IRWM regions are also working with their disadvantaged communities.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I have one.
Yes.
I don't know if this is a regular update or not. It's helpful to get this information, and thank you. And I'm... The map that you provided was interesting to see the comparison of funding area allocations. I'm wondering, you must have also a breakdown of what types of projects are being funded in each of these areas?
In Proposition 84, yes, we have.
Yeah.
And,
at some point, it'd be okay. Interesting yes. to see that.
We have some very interesting slides on the type of projects. And one of the other things that is kind of, again, it's a trivia point, but we have awarded about $500 million in Proposition 84 funding, and our average grant per project amount is $1.25 million. So we're funding a lot of projects, but a very small amount. So some of them are small projects with a large amount, and some of them are big projects with a small amount. But we're funding a lot of projects.
So, I mean, it'd be interesting to see not only the type of projects, but what sort of gains you're seeing in terms of water quality improvement or watershed management. Do you have that kind of assessment by now?
We're working on it.
Yeah.
So when we get a little bit of quiet time.
Yeah. Okay. You're not going to get any quiet time, but it'd be interesting to see that. I mean, I have to say, so I was involved in IRWIMPS a while ago. I've been away from it. I'm coming back to it. So if I'm asking information that's kind of known. It's partly me getting up to speed, but I have a feeling that's...
It's stuff that we kind of haven't quite gotten to. It's not ready for prime time. So we'll work on it.
It'll be great to see an assessment like that, because that's obviously what everybody hoped for in terms of integration. It's to be seeing more benefits like that. All right, thank you.
Commissioner Rivera.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you, Tracy, for coming today and providing this information. It's very, very helpful, especially for those of us that are very involved in IRWM. We certainly look forward to working more with the department on providing input and recommendations, and hopefully getting on the stakeholder engagement advisory committee. One question that I had is related to a lot of the recommendations and reports that have been developed and given to DWR. I mean, I know there was a number of money spent through Prop 84 to develop recommendations as part of the ZSDAC pilot projects. And then I think in early December of 2014, a number of representatives from all of the various regions came together and developed a more formalized, one report that tried to pull together all of the recommendations. I'm wondering what the department's plan is to incorporate those recommendations and guidance in this program this go around.
It's definitely one of the source documents that we'll be looking at for ideas and concepts to bring forward. And so I think we need to get into the specifics of the recommendations and how they fit in with the program. And so it's definitely something we will be looking at.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you, Tracy. All right, so we'll come up to item 12, update on program and administrative activities for the Water Storage Investment Program. Jenny Marr.
Thank you, commissioners. I need 5-second technical timeout. Again, thank you for having me today. You'll notice from your packet, it's quite extensive. We didn't get to do an administrative and program update at the Fresno meeting. So you've got between the program and administrative update and the C&E update, quite a substantial packet to go through. And I put together a quick PowerPoint just to point out the highlights. So for the administrative update side, we updated the project schedule. So in your packet, you'll have a Gantt chart and a high-level graphic. The biggest changes being for the Gantt chart, and that can replace the one that was provided a couple months ago. We have been coordinating with legal counsel on what should be in the regulations package, and it was determined that the regulations package should include the guidelines. And previously, our schedule had included a little bit of lag between the regulations, the guidelines, and the PSP. And since the guidelines and regulations will be submitted together, we took out the lag and bought ourselves a little bit of time in developing the admin draft of the package. So originally, we were going to come to the commission at the end of summer, beginning of fall, with administrative drafts of the regulations. But since we bought a couple months, we'll be coming in September, and you will see an administrative draft in September and again in October for submittal and approval for the notice to proceed or notice of formal rulemaking for OAL in November. So that's the biggest change to the schedule. Also included in your packet is an updated organization chart and a topic schedule for the working sessions. So you'll see working session topics through September to help us get direction from you on specific issues staff are working through to develop content for the regulations package. One of the things I'd like to point out is the July issue working session, as I mentioned before in response to a question, we'll be coming back with the goals, objectives, and principles document. So I think some of the items that we heard from Mr. Quinn and Ms. Davis, we can definitely bring up again in that, and how to in revising the goals and objectives and principles document, and how we can revise that to include a broader program vision, and how we would like to consider human right to water in our program. In your packet is this more high-level depiction of our schedule. I apologize, it's difficult to see on the screen, but there is a hard copy in everyone's packets. The things to point out in this schedule, it represents kind of the maximum amount of time that we're considering at this point. So in 2015, we're really stressing development of a draft regulations package that the commission will approve in November for submitting the notice of proposed rulemaking to OAL. That initiates a up to a year process of a public comment, review, and meetings on the rule on our proposed regulation package, and that can take up to a year. And we're considering at this point in time in our scheduling that it will take up to a year. But staff is definitely ready to proceed if it takes one 45-day comment period, respond to comments, and we're done. Optimistically, that's the best-case scenario, and we'd be ready to move forward and finalize the PSP and get started with the program as soon as we can get approved regulations out there. Then right now we've got the 2017 timeline initiating our grant program, developing the draft PSP, putting that out for public review and conducting public meetings, revising it, and initiating the application development process. So for updating on the regulations package, or the draft regulations package that we're putting together, we've begun revising the draft guidelines. We did have a guidelines package from 2012, but we are utilizing staff from the IRWM branch, or the financial assistance branch, the IRWM program, to help us revise those draft guidelines and include a lot of the standard language that state grant programs include. And so they're busy working on that right now. We worked on the application review process flowcharts, which we daylighted for you yesterday during the issue working session, and we'll continue to flesh that out and present that to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee in July. We've been working on draft definitions that will be included in the regulations and the guidelines, and you've seen some early drafts of those for project types, public benefits, tributaries to the Delta, some of the specific definitions that staff are working on and working with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee on. We had a meeting with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee the first week of May, and we talked about the project types and public benefits definitions with them, and we received comments from individual participants on the Stakeholder Advisory Committee on May 15th. Unfortunately, we weren't able to package those in time to bring them forth to this meeting, but we'll have them ready for the next meeting so you can see the comments we've been receiving from the Stakeholder Advisory Committee on those. We've been working closely with the agency team, and the agency team includes Delta Stewardship Council, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and State Water Resources Control Board to update the draft priorities, relative value, and metrics to help us evaluate the priorities and relative value. And we'll be presenting those priorities, or I should say, the State Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife will be presenting the priorities and framework for determining relative value to the Commission in July. We're actually bringing those to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee in June for review and comment. We're doing the presentation to the Commission in July just because we're traveling for the June meeting and to make sure that we didn't have to bring a whole entourage with us to San Jose. The technical team, we've established an engineering work group and an economics work group. The engineering work group has been working to develop a framework for without project conditions, and there are certain components of that without project condition that we will be asking all project proponents to utilize, so we can make sure that when we're comparing benefits to projects, everyone's not using different baselines. For the economics work group, they've been developing an economic analysis framework. That's been presented to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, and it will also be presented to a lesser extent, just for timing, at the public meeting this afternoon. And we will bring that commented on economic analysis framework to the Commission also in July. We've been developing economics analysis standard values, things like what dollar year are we asking all projects to present their economic benefits and economic costs in. Right now we're looking at 2014, but that is just, we're developing proposals to bring to the Commission later in the summer. We've been looking at what should be used for a state discount rate, so we're starting those really in-depth, in-the-weeds discussions of what should be included in the applications as far as an economic analysis goes. And we've been drafting the scope of work for determining economic unit values. We consider this to be some technical assistance that will be provided in our PSP and guidelines package that will help potential applicants and people doing economic analysis with regional and timing-specific economic unit values to use in evaluating their projects. We also have an environmental work group. They've been meeting regularly with the State Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife to help them update their draft priorities. We've also been developing that framework for relative value and started identifying potential metrics for determining and evaluating values for those priorities. So we'll open that up for questions. That was a rather quick update.
Commissioner Ball.
Well, thank you for that. As usual, you're doing a great job, and you've got a lot of things that are ongoing. I'd like to look at the one-page timeline project planning summary, which you stated is that's a worst-case scenario.
I think it could be worse, but that's what we're planning on, at least for this. I think everything hinges on 2016 and that formal rulemaking process. When we initiate it, generally you allow for up to a year, and that's what we're planning on at this point. For us, it includes one 45-day public comment period and two 15-day public comment periods, but it has not been unheard of that process takes a little bit longer.
Is this a roll-up of the more in-depth Gantt chart and
yes,
all
it is.
The different activities?
Yes.
Okay. I think it would be helpful to look at not a worst case, but a realistic case. Because as I look at this, by the end of 2016, December 15th, we can start issuing funds to projects. Mm-hmm. And from the look of things here, we're not going to be able to do that until well over a year past that. And if I'm the public and I'm looking at the conditions under which these funds were approved in Prop 1 and looking at the actions of the commission and saying, I can't believe it. One year after the date that you could have started awarding funds, you still haven't done anything. And I'm very mindful of that in the public perception of our actions and actually getting something done. And I think that we should be diligent in going back through the detail and coming up with what we think is, one, a realistic plan, but a plan that is definitely faster than this, and a plan that starts saying, is it possible for us to start awarding funds really the beginning of 2017? Is there any scenario that we could do that? And I'd be very interested in looking at how we expedite this process and what actions can be taken and by whom. And obviously there are certain time constraints where we have to post something, there has to be a certain number of days, and we have to get that back. And if there's comment or dissent, then we have to act on that, and it takes another time frame. But let's try to tighten this up. I really think that we need to be faster than this, and we owe it to the public to try to be prepared to issue funds as soon as possible after the allowable date of December 15th of 2016.
Thank you.
Just one other quick question for you. As you look at the economic planning, are you looking at making the financial analysis done in 2014 dollars merely because there are more metrics as opposed to doing it in current dollars?
Yeah, I think from what we've heard from the economists, because we are writing the draft regulations now, they have all the information they need for 2015 or 2014 and doing the discount rate, and they wouldn't be able to do any estimates for 2015 until next year. So that's why they've decided on 2014 at this point.
Yeah, it seems a little obtuse to do it that way when not doing it in current dollars. I was thinking that you were actually going to try and project it into future dollars as opposed to going backwards, because with the way that the escalations are going, particularly in the construction cost side of things, that to put it into last year's dollars is going to give us an incorrect picture of what these things are actually costing, going to cost.
We will definitely talk to the economists about that then.
Thank you.
Commissioner Daniels.
Thank you. I have a few different areas of questions. And so one is, I want to mention again what I brought up yesterday about getting a draft earlier. I see in your timeline here and what you've just provided in terms of updates that the plan was to get the draft guidelines to us formally in September and October for submittal in November. And while, you know, that is a two-month period of time, for something as large as this, that's actually kind of a short period of time to really comment and weigh in. And part of the reason I'm hoping to see the draft guidelines, and I'd be interested to hear what my fellow commissioners think about this, is that the other decisions that have been presented to us will fit into those guidelines. It's definitely helpful, I think, for me, as well as members of the public who are presenting projects or wanting to comment on them, to see the context in which those definitions or other small, you know, they're small because they're definitions, but they have large consequences. So it'd be important to see how they fit into that context. So if it's possible to have the draft guidelines earlier, I would like that for one. I think it'd be helpful. And I understand why you're timing it out this way, because there's a lot of work internally to figure out aspects of it, so it might make you hurry it up, or maybe you can embrace the fact that it's not quite fully developed and that's the place where we're going to be able to interact before it's too hardwired.
Yeah.
And, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And thank you. I appreciate the comment. And we will definitely look at trying to condense as much as we can to get earlier drafts out. I think the schedule right now reflects the timing issues that we're having with getting feedback back, that every couple weeks we're getting feedback from the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, and then we have a commission meeting. And so it's reflecting a little bit of a expanded timeline, even though this is rather quick to be developing these draft documents.
It is. It's a lot of work.
It's showing that there's a robust outreach effort kind of involved in getting them put together as well.
Well, I wonder if, you know, it's interesting territory to wade into when you're developing something and being completely transparent about it might actually be helpful, where you show the holes and say, look, we're filling in here, and this is where we need you to fill in. Because right now, I don't think anybody knows where they're filling in.
Okay.
So I would personally be okay with that. I think it'd be helpful. And it might even help some project proponents start thinking about their own projects and how it might fit in, even though it's not final and there's a longer process. The other thing I just wanted to get clear on is the public opportunity comments during rulemaking, because I had a different perception of how rulemaking worked. And I just want to be clear on that I thought that once we presented a rule for submittal to the internal review processes, and I'm using a federal term in OMB. I'm involved in some federal rulemaking, so I'm using different agency terms. But I know there's a number of agency reviews that have to happen, and my understanding is you need to be fairly final before those internal agency reviews go on. So I just wanted to be clear on how much adaptability there would be in the rule once it's submitted in November. So how much influence can the public comment have once the rule's submitted?
My understanding, and I will look to Maureen to correct any error I may make, is that when it's submitted to OAL in November 2017, or 2015, it's just the notice of proposed rulemaking, and during that time, we will have three public meetings, we'll have several, if needed, public comment periods. If there's substantial comments and changes, it'd require a 45-day. If it was not substantial, require a 15-day review. And once that process is over and it's submitted to OAL, and we're planning on that for November 2016, then it's internal OAL review where it's considered relatively final.
Right.
And they have
so
a 30-day.
So from November, that's – sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Go ahead.
From November, actually, it'll probably end up being more end of October 2016, they have a 30-day review period where they take it internal and are required to provide comments and would approve it at that point.
Okay.
Maureen, you can add.
Right, and part of how long it takes depends on how many comments we have to respond to, and then, as Jenny's mentioned, there's a 45-day turnaround period for the initial round, and then if it goes back to them for either procedural problems or substantive problems, then there can be another 15-day time period for each time it goes back and forth between OAL.
So the public comments, and then do we have a role as a commission? So we can then redirect the public comments?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. All right, thank you. Finally, just a final question. Do we know who's on the different work groups that you mentioned, the engineering, economics, environmental work groups?
Yeah, in your packet there is a personnel org chart, and on the lower right-hand side of that there's three white boxes that lays out the current staff on the economics work group, engineering work group, and environmental work group.
Got it.
And these
thank
are
you.
Staff groups.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Orth.
I want to share that the concerns about being in a situation as a commission where we're, you know, a year plus delayed in awarding funds from where what was written in the statute. However, I think as I understand this, I think this is your best estimate of how we fully engage the public and plan for perhaps several rounds of public comment and response during early 2016. And while I certainly agree that we ought to try to do everything we can to shorten the time frame, I also think that the Commission needs to be very sensitive to the public input objectives that were written in Chapter 8 and make sure that we provide the public adequate comment period and response. I don't want to get caught in an equal trap that we've only given 30 or 45 days in a one-shot review because we were so bent on getting the money out that the public then comes back and criticizes the lack of entry points that they had. So the challenge is to find that sweet spot. Right? And I don't know what it is because we're trying to look into a crystal ball and anticipate public comment that we can't anticipate at this point. So anything, you know, as that consideration is being done, I kind of like the idea of maybe some earlier conversations, maybe more stakeholder advisory committee input on this timing and process issue to try to help inform us and you how to condense this as much as reasonable without, you know, exposing us on either end.
And we have received some input from stakeholders on the stakeholder advisory committee in the form of comment letters that we received on Friday. And there was quite a few of them that asked us to slow down. So we'll try to find that sweet spot in scheduling.
Yes, Commissioner Ball.
I appreciate the comments you're making. Being in the private sector, if we took this long to do anything, we would be out of business. And so forgive my comments to that extent, in that I'm used to a different time frame and a different timeline, and I fully appreciate the comments you made, and I do agree that in this process, although I'm looking for an expedited process, I do think it's vitally important to properly listen to the public and to all the stakeholders that we have, because they will have very important points of view that we have to take seriously, and I agree with you on that.
Commissioner Curtin.
So I have a term of art that I'm a little confused about, and maybe it'll help with Paul's question. The draft regulations that you submit, I mean, when I think of a draft, I think of a draft, but technically speaking, once you submit the draft, we kick in the OAL timeline. So what we're doing is we have a draft of the draft that we're kicking around in a less formal process. And I know we had original guidelines when we were all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed after 2010, and, you know, we were ready to try to get going. And I've heard that we've already got substantial guidelines, but I don't think we've actually, especially for newer members, have gotten to take a look at those and where they are. And if that's what I think you might be getting at, so really it's more of the draft of the draft. And I don't have any trouble with holding up as long as possible to submitting the draft, but that's only based on the idea that holding it up before we start the formal deadline timelines going is so that we can get as good a product to the OAL, having vetted it as much in the public without having a 45-minute day waiting period and a 15-day response period and so on and so forth. So we need to get as much input out of the public as we can. And I guess that's the assumption here.
Yes.
So we really need to get the stakeholders focused on the kind of things that are going to go into this, so that's essentially what we're vetting them and using them to vet. And I don't, you know, I'm not presupposing what's going on there, but that seems to me to be the key focus, because the longer it takes to get the rules made, the harder it is for the proponents to get their act together. And I have a very simple question. What does PSP stand for again?
Proposal solicitation package.
There you go. Okay, I knew it was proposal solicitation question mark. So it seems also that if we could somehow, and I know we can't get a formal proposals kicked into gear, but if we can do a similar type thing in an informal way, that if these were happen to be, maybe could be, possibly the regulations, you might want to start getting your proposal solicitation package together and go through a bit of an informal process, so that in 2017 we're not spending 4 months, completely 4 months, so that if we do and somehow magically end up getting the rulemaking done because of this work we've done ahead of time in June or July, and hey, guess what, we're signed off, and we have been sort of sending out the draft, I mean, they'll see all this, it's all in the public, but if we're encouraging them to, the moment this is out, this is pretty much what the proposal solicitation package is going to look like. We'll have to go through, I mean, are these public meetings also statutory meetings that we go through in the proposed solicitation package?
The ones in 2017 are not. The only ones that are included are the public meetings in 2016 on the guidelines.
All right, that's what I thought. So those are the statutory required. What are the required public meetings for the proposed solicitation package?
Before we go to that, I want to just clarify one thing, that there are public meeting requirements built into the statute for the guidelines. In the regulatory process, there's a separate requirement for a set of public meetings. And in general, in a rulemaking, you're not required to have a public hearing unless it's requested, but we're going to go ahead and do that. But when you have what's called a complex regulation, the statute requires you to have several public meetings in advance of the rulemaking process, and we're doing that as well. So those are both statutorily
required. I got that part.
We're
doing a great job on all that. It's very interesting, and it's a lot of work for you guys, so I get that. But I'm talking about if we somehow manage to miraculously get a rulemaking done prior to November of 2016, we're down to the 2017 proposal solicitation package.
That would bump up.
That would bump up, of course. The public meetings, which we have a month and a half of, or a month of, are they statutorily required in the okay, so all I'm saying is if we could be ready to rock and roll if we magically get this done, we might actually get money out the door closer to the time you're talking about. And we will have to do a lot of work because we're going to have to understand the vision of it and the large-scale questions and the smaller projects that might be very clear. We could move some quick money out there. I mean, all that sort of stuff. But there seems to be room here because the 4 months before we put the package out, just the package, and then the application development period, that's pretty substantial. I mean, we really do have to have that timeline or some portion of that timeline for the application development period. But the more the applications are refined by the applicants, the shorter that period may be.
Yeah.
So that's what it seems to be like a lot of, you know, potential there. And, again, if our preliminary work ends up establishing a very quick rulemaking process. So I'm not optimistic because it's such controversial stuff we're dealing with. But nonetheless, it's possible. I think, you know, we might actually get close to not getting run out of town on a rail if we really push it. So.
And currently staff are working on all three documents at the same time.
Yeah.
We're pulling together a large amount of information. A few months ago, Tracy had presented a table that said what was in the statute, what goes in the regulations, what goes in the guidelines, and what goes on the PSP. Yeah. So we're taking that, and that was a while ago. We're taking this large pool of information and trying to parse out what needs to go in each. So they're all going, they're all being worked on concurrently. I mean, the guidelines we're definitely focusing on first. Just there's a lot of experience in developing the guidelines and what needs to go in there, and that helps to determine what should go in the regulations and what should go in the PSP. But we are working on them concurrently, so definitely what is in the development for 2017 in the PSP, that can be shortened. A lot of it could just be formatting too, that the words could only fit in that amount of space, but we know we can.
I got you. Yeah, that's why I said it looks like a month and a half, but that's because meetings is a long word.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are planning on a 30-day comment period and doing three public meetings. Just that's standard practice. It's not required, but that's typical for the IRWM program.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we may be able to, and I know we'd have to get extra people or else you'll all be dead by the end of this process, but, I mean, we don't have to have a meeting every month. We could have three meetings in a month in different areas with a group that's going out and then packaging those together and have one meeting and wrap it up and move on. I mean, that's the kind of stuff. But I know contemplating that from your end is probably, you know, a little scary. But at that point, we need to be saying, okay, let's contract out some of the efforts here and bring them in from other areas and get it going.
Any other questions or comments? Yes. Commissioner.
Thanks, Jenny. Because given that I'm new, I'm really interested in maybe having a briefing to talk more about the stakeholder engagement process and how that's working, what the vision is for that, and also how the agendas are established and how then we utilize the input that's being provided there, how we incorporate that into the decisions that we as a commission are going to be making. I think, you know, we could probably expedite things and be able to make decisions quicker if we had a more focused, well-established program in a way that we can seek the input that we need in a timely manner and then use that to help us move forward on decisions we're struggling with as well. I certainly would be interested in having that conversation with staff, and I don't know if other commissioners would like to join that about how we can work with you to try to maybe see if there's room for improvement moving forward.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be great.
I agree with that. I think that's a good direction, and I think it'd be helpful for us to think about what sort of questions we might want to submit to the stakeholder advisory committee meeting, you know, for the next time. Maybe even we can have that discussion today. But, you know, following on Commissioner Curtin's comments about it is a lot of work to prepare for these monthly meetings, maybe that is something we could think about, is having longer meetings, but at one time. That may not be a solution because it may be a matter of timing things out too. But there also may be a point in time when we have a joint meeting with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting.
Right? When is the next stakeholder meeting?
June 3rd.
June 3rd.
And all the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meetings are in Sacramento, and that one will be at the Cal EPA building.
Any others?
Is there a comment?
Yes.
Thank you, Jenny, and please make sure you extend our thanks to all of the people working on this in your team, and thank you to Rachel for all the really good work that you're doing. Really appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, so then that takes care of item 13. 12.
I wish.
Yeah, I jumped ahead of myself. Okay. All right. When does this come in? Now? Okay. We will have a comment now from Daniel Hegarty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. I just missed the public comment period earlier in the morning. I drove 2 hours to get here. My name is Daniel Hegarty. I'm a resident in Marin County, California. I co-chaired a commission much like this in another state for 7 years that distributed a lot of money, millions of dollars, all in water. So I have a deep appreciation and an empathy for what you're faced with in terms of trying to put together a process to make this all right. And I greatly appreciate what you're doing and the questions that you're asking of staff and that sensitivity of all of that. I would like to just very briefly, because I know it's lunchtime, talk about one particular element. I've been reviewing the draft guidelines and regulations just regarding the public trust doctrine. I came before you in the January meeting to describe to you or to ask you to look at the public trust doctrine as a public trust resource, as is stated here, but it is very narrowly constructed within your existing draft guidance document. And I would encourage you to see yourselves as trustees. All the funds that you distribute are going to influence water resources for the future, and that makes you trustees of the water resource. And there are other agencies like the Water Board, of course. But incumbent upon that is looking out for all interests and future generations. And I think that's where we are missing a lot of our policy discussions, is what does it look like 20 and 30 and 40 years from now? So to you, going back to your earlier discussion about a vision for the commission, I would encourage you to really look at a long-term vision. And as you distribute monies and as you frame how what people should be proposing or how they propose to be considered, how are they addressing this as a public trust asset for the people of California and for the future generations? And it puts it in a little bit different context than what I'm seeing now. The language right now on the public trust doctrine is narrow, and I think it unnecessarily keeps it too narrow in terms of how you would address that or how you would ask applicants to address that. I think that it needs to be more visionary as a public trust doctrine principle. And it needs to be looking out for future generations. Now, the burden on that in terms of how to frame it, I think that maybe the committee that developed this is getting a little bit too hung up on being really specific about it. There's a lot of legalese in there right now, which I don't think is very helpful. But I think simple questions like, how are you, applicant, going to address or benefit this trust asset, water, for now and future generations, let them define how they're going to get there. But you have clarity at the beginning in terms of your expectation. So I'll leave it at that for now. I think I'll write more up as written comments based on the conversations I heard this morning. I think I can be a little bit more specific later on. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Could I just ask a question? Because you don't have any slides, so I need an example. Either I need a picture or an example. So can you sort of explain what you said in terms of an example? It's too narrow. It's not this. It's not that. I'm assuming that these projects, and I'm maybe that's my problem. I'm assuming we're supposed to be looking at as much as possible long-term issues, and it's revolved around storage. So that would be almost by definition part of the public trust, or how it's going to look in 20 years, 30 years, 4 years. So is there something more specific you're getting at that I'm not getting?
Commissioner, I think you're hitting it. What I'm suggesting is the draft right now keeps it to water quality and particular benefits that water quality might bring to fisheries. Walla, I would suggest that you should also be looking at it as public access, the public right to water. The public trust is water as a trust asset, and you're trustees of that asset, and that's pretty encompassing. So it doesn't change what you just framed, but I think it just brings more clarity in terms of how comprehensive this can be, and not as it is now, kind of pushed down to a water quality issue with some specific benefits on just water quality. Does it help?
Slightly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's unfortunately, we don't have a lot of language around the public trust other than.
I understand. I actually think that was a part of our discussion this morning about trying to do the best we can by encouraging projects to be a lot more holistic, one of my least favorite words, but it works here, which I think would include the long-term public trust issues and certainly the short-term kind of emergency and access issues that you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
So
I concur.
I think you have, at least from everything I'm hearing, you got a lot of sympathy up here about trying to figure out how to do that. But, within our charge to some degree also. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, the public trust is an overarching statutory requirement. So it doesn't even actually have to be within our charge to include it in our understanding. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think we had a little bit on that. So, yeah, I think we, yeah. I get it, but not really the specifics of what you're getting at. So
I'll put more in writing.
All right, good.
To you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, so we'll move on to update on stakeholder process for water storage investment program. Jenny again.
Are we breaking for lunch or not? So it's lunchtime.
No.
Okay, either we are or we're not.
Oh, sorry.
The intent was not to break for lunch. At this point, there is a public meeting at 1:30 following this, but no, there
were
not. At the Library Galleria.
It's not a stakeholder meeting.
It is a public meeting, not a meeting of the stakeholder committee.
Okay.
I believe we have lunch arranged if you would like to stay and attend that meeting, but the intent was to finish the rest of the items on this agenda before lunch.
Okay.
All right, so I guess that means we should move on.
Yes.
All right, Jenny?
First, I'm standing between everyone and lunch.
The only one who can stop us, Jenny.
So I'll quickly go through this. Changes to our communication and engagement program and some updates. We updated the communication and engagement schedule, so you'll see that in the 11x17 handout in your packet. I'll highlight some of the changes. We added an October stakeholder advisory committee meeting to talk about the draft regulations package and the draft PSP. We added a new series of public workshops in October to shop around the draft regulations package. We moved the June 17th public workshop to the July meeting.
just for logistical purposes, and it's easier to get those kind of meetings in Sacramento than when the commission's traveling. And then we changed the location of the July 27th public meeting from Reading to Napa. So since our last meeting, or last CNE update, we've conducted two stakeholder advisory committee meetings in April and May. To this point, the stakeholder advisory committee meetings have really focused on getting everyone up to speed and on the same page. They've been a lot more education and information than consultation and advisory, but that is quickly going to change. And we will make sure that we're now, now that we've kind of got the 101 on covered with the stakeholder advisory committee, we're going to be deep diving into specific issues. And there's summaries of the stakeholder advisory committee meetings in your packet. We've conducted three public workshops. Summaries of those meetings are included in your packet. We planned a May 20th public workshop, and that's what we were just talking about, at 1:30 today in the Secopolis Galleria at the Sacramento Public Library. That'll go from 1:30 to 4:30, and there's more details. This is just the high-level summary. We've continued to collect information from the scoping survey. As Rachel alluded to, that will be closing at the end of the month. We've engaged in planning for the June 9th tribal consultation workshop, and we've brainstormed a state and federal coordination meeting, and we're going to hold two agency coordination meetings, one in July and one in September. We have not set those dates yet, but we know that it's important to get state and federal input into our process, so we're going to coordinate two meetings to specifically hear some input. So the stakeholder advisory committee meeting, there's just a slide that quickly goes over what we talked about, and you've got the meeting summary. Again, it was kickoff, introductions, we went over the charter, we spent a lot of time reviewing the statute, because I think that's important for anyone just embarking on this program to learn what is contained within the statute. We reviewed project eligibility requirements and began brainstorming some of the definitions that you saw drafts at in Fresno. The May 4th meeting, we discussed the framework for using economics to quantify benefits. During that meeting, they requested that the economists come back with some examples of how to apply this framework. So we are currently working on that and plan to present those examples at the July meeting. We reviewed the draft definitions of the state water system, public benefits, and project types. We received comments on those definitions on May 15th, and we're packaging those comments right now. And we discussed the development of updated priorities and relative value. So the Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife came and did presentations to, I guess, whet the appetite of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, because they're coming back in June to do a few-hour workshop on presenting those draft priorities and relative value and soliciting stakeholder input. So the public meetings, April 13th in Chico, we had over 300 attendees. We had a packed house. It may have been closer to 400 or 500, but we knew we had 300 chairs, and they were all full, and they were standing room only. April 15th in Fresno, we had about 40 attendees. That was in conjunction with a commission meeting, and we had a lot more attendance at the commission meeting. And April 21st in Pleasant Hill, we had about 30 attendees. A lot of the themes from the meetings was definitely public perception of what was voted for, and there was regional splits and what projects were definitely promoted at the meetings, and we heard a lot of concerns about the current drought and how it's impacting quality of life and communities throughout the state. And there's summaries of those public meetings in your packet. And are coming up, and we've got a lot of activities in the couple month look ahead. Again, today is that public workshop, and it is a public workshop, but we did send a special invitation to folks that filled out the scoping survey. One of our goals of the meeting is to start, in the interest of integration, is to start providing forums for project proponents to get together and talk about their project concepts and what they're working on and what they're considering, and, you know, maybe giving them an opportunity to coordinate with other projects that are being considered in their region. We have a June 3rd Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting. Again, that's in Sacramento at the Cal EPA building, and that's, those are all-day meetings. June 9th to 10th, we have a tribal consultation workshop. June 17th is the commission meeting in San Jose. July 1st is another Stakeholder Advisory Committee. June 15th being the commission meeting back in Sacramento in conjunction with another public workshop. And our public workshop at that time will focus on the process flow charts and how applications will be reviewed and the evaluation methodology that we are proposing. And end of July, we're going out on another public meeting series. So that will go from July to August 10th, and we'll focus on the priorities and relative value. So Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Water Board will be coming with us on those public workshops to present those. We'll also be talking about evaluation methods we'll use during reviewing applications. And end of July, actually, I think we're going to do it closer to the second or third week in July, we'll hold the state and federal agency coordination meeting. So I think I quickly got through that.
Yeah. You've got a pretty good schedule ahead of you.
Yes.
Ahead of yourself. Yeah. Okay. Any comments, questions?
Yeah.
Commissioner Quintero?
I just understand from Rachel that all of us will be getting copies of the slide sets that Jenny used. They'll be a nice index for us. Thank you.
That'd be useful. Thank you. Commissioner Ball.
So you attend every one of these meetings?
I do.
Yeah. And thank you for doing that.
Of course. yeah. We've worked with staff and definitely have made a schedule and prioritization of who attends what, but Rachel and I attend all of these.
Yeah, and we've had many or most of the meetings, members of the Water Commission there, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And I found that the meetings that I went to be very informative and very useful. At the stakeholders meetings, just understand the broad number of different interests that have a variety of opinions. And there can be some pretty spirited conversation there because they definitely don't agree. And it's good for them to be in a forum where they actually get to challenge each other. But that I think that's a really good process. And, I think to understand the process, you got to go to one of these things and see what's going on because it's really good. And then just to participate, we had a pretty easy time at Pleasant Hill. That was a very friendly meeting.
Pleasant Hill.
Yeah.
And Happy Valley. Our next meeting is going to be in Happy Valley.
I know it was a little bit tougher than the Chico meeting. So thanks for handling that, Danny. But these are great. I think we're getting a lot of information from these, and I think it's definitely a two-way thing. So very, very productive, really good, and thank you.
Thank you.
Is it possible that the commissioner is the person who sets the environment?
I was wondering why I saw a posters of my face on the way up there.
With targets.
Yeah, yeah. Watch out for this guy. He's coming to town.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
I just want to point out that there's a pretty extensive set of materials that you submitted as well that capture the stakeholder comments and so forth. They're all in the meeting packet. So thank you so much. This really, every time I bring up something new for you to do, I want you to know that it's not in the context of not fully appreciating how much work there is here. One question I have, though, is are the Stakeholder Advisory Committee members willing to have their name listed with their comments? Because what you have are so far are one member expressed, another member expressed. Are they willing to be identified? I don't know if that's an issue or not, but it might be helpful.
We haven't specifically asked them if, so to this point, we've been not attributing comments to individuals, but we'll ask them if they're comfortable with that.
So might be helpful. Off the top of my head, I don't know if that's a great idea. Part of the problem is they are stakeholders, and we're trying to find consensus among differing stakeholders. And, you know, stakeholder A representing such and such said such and such, and anybody reads these meetings or could be problematic. I think it should be raised, but we really want to get open dialogue. I mean,
so you think that might encourage people discourage
the open dialogue because everybody's going to just cover their butt.
Somehow I have a feeling they won't be discouraged, but it, you know.
Go to the meeting. Check it out.
I did.
Yeah, okay. Oh, you did, okay.
Yeah, I think it might be the opposite effect. I think they might then want to get their comment on the record, so that might be an issue in terms of just having synthesized discussion. But, yeah, all right, so maybe next we can talk about sending questions over. And if we were to send questions over, then the question is what process would be for responding. And I would ask that, if we do that, then we ask them to figure out a process, whether they want to just do a roll call vote and just send over the votes and let us know that, or what?
Yeah, we certainly do need to figure out a process for getting stakeholder input, because right now we're just receiving formal comment letters. And, you know, having to go through those and then parse out all the comments and repackage them at a vote or trying another venue for getting comments, I think we can look into.
Yeah, you've got a pretty tough job there to get a consensus when you have so differing.
Yeah, I don't think there will be. So, I mean, for me, what would be helpful is just to know that there are a variety of viewpoints.
Yep.
And then I feel like it would be my job as a commissioner to just weigh that and factor into that, which is why it's helpful for me to know who's saying it, but that's up to them. But I want to know the viewpoints. I'm right now reading the comments that I remember being part of the discussion there. So it's helpful to have it in one place. So even if there's not a complete consensus, just to know what the pros and cons were that were discussed, I think would be helpful.
Yeah. I agree. I think that's – we can probably –
Figure it out
ourselves. Put the burden on us, but I think that's the best way because they may not reach a consensus, and some people will never, you know, agree. But it would be good for us to look at those, and also if there's any direct comments that go directly to the staff, either written or verbal, we should probably know those too, and just to get an idea of what all these ideas that are coming in.
Certainly, and we do have a package that we're putting together for the next meeting. I'll put this on me. I wasn't thinking ahead when I asked for comments by May 15th that they would all arrive at 4 o'clock on May 15th on Friday, a couple days before a Tuesday commission meeting. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to get the package together in time and get it copied, but it'll certainly be in the next meeting packet.
Yeah, it's a lot of work for them, too.
Yeah, of
That's
course.
Part of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Of course.
But I want to follow up just briefly. So if some members want to be identified and some don't, I think that it's all to be respected, by the way. You know, if they would prefer to be anonymous, we would completely respect that. If some would prefer to be identified, which I don't know if that makes it harder for you or not, though. So anyway.
We could do name placards in different colors or something to identify who's okay with their name being attributed.
I have a feeling they'll want it.
Yeah, we'll definitely raise that with them at the next stakeholder meeting and also look at what's the best process that we can use to consolidate feedback from the stakeholder committee in a way that's really usable for you.
Okay. All right. So if there's no other comments on this, then we just go to consider items for the next meeting.
So our next meeting is going to be June 17th in San Jose. What we had been brainstorming from a staff perspective is keeping out-of-town meetings to one day generally, but moving to two-day meetings for Sacramento meetings. If that's agreeable to the commission, and we can obviously update it as needed as we get to specific meetings. So the thought was to have a one-day meeting in San Jose. Most of the focus will be on the water storage investment program. We'll bring back to you our program update and outreach update, as we always do, and we'll have a fairly robust issue working session. As Jenny mentioned, we'll bring back the definitions of public benefits with the consolidated stakeholder input so that you can see that and what specific comments were made to the different definitions. We'll also have a proposal for environmental permitting considerations. We'll have project eligibility criteria. We'll bring back the definition of tributaries to the Delta with the additional information that was asked for yesterday. We'll also work with the members of the commission between now and then to see what we can put together in terms of a policy document or a resolution for a vision for the water storage investment program. The other item that we are going to have at that meeting is an update on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Groundwater Sustainability Plan draft principles. So we'll have that at that meeting. We'll also be following up on the other requests from the meetings, including how to incorporate human right to water, getting you guys a list of communities with a lack of access to safe drinking water, and also potentially some other information on financial resources. At other agencies and within other chapters in Proposition 1. So we'll be looking at when we can bring those items back to you as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any final comments or questions? Commissioner Orth?
Quick question. Do we also anticipate to have a significant amount of time committed for public comment as was done in Fresno? And I just heard an agenda that will take the better part of 8 hours, and if we're going to have public comment, I'm just curious.
We'll have public comment at every meeting. Given the direction of the commission, we can limit public comments to 3 minutes.
I guess maybe part of the question to follow up on that, but I have a different one also, is do you expect there will be a lot of people in attendance at that one, depending on the outreach?
It's hard to say. Very hard to predict. We have Fresno a room for 170 folks. Make that reaction is that it may be fewer than attended in Fresno, but I really don't know.
So I had a couple other questions, if the chair would allow. On the human right to water, with the list of communities impacted, that's going to be very important. Thank you for bringing that forward. Is there, as you do that, would there be a way to layer in the information on groundwater, some of the groundwater work that was mentioned earlier by...
Yeah, I think so. So identifying which of those communities are in different priority basins.
Yeah, I think
we can do that.
I think that'd be a helpful layer for analysis. And then the resolution, if we really are going to use the resolution to articulate a vision, I think that would be a very long discussion. So I just want to be happy to work with you on the agenda to think through how to provide enough time for that discussion and public comment, because I think that would draw a lot of public comment as well, would be my guess, if we're putting something forward that articulates a direction. And I do want to see if we have space somehow to do what both Tim Quinn and Debbie Davis-Franco talked to us about this morning, about being engines for innovation. So where does that come in? Where does that type of thinking come in, and how do we grapple with that? I just want to think about it between now and then, what space we provide for that. And one suggestion I have is, I think updates are critically important. They're so great to have. Typically, they do come before you get to meatier parts of the agenda. But I'm wondering if what my fellow commissioners think about flipping it so that we just make sure we have time for discussion and put the updates later. Because if we can get the information just from a PowerPoint or a quick presentation, then we won't spend as much time on questions. We don't know how much we're spending in terms of time because it's earlier rather than later.
I appreciate those suggestions, and thank you for the offer of working with staff on the agenda. So
yeah, I'd be happy to if you want.
Yeah.
Okay. Nothing further, then we'll adjourn the meeting.
But-
Yeah.
They add a quick little tab.